Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, going to be talking about the continued destruction of public education. In Philadelphia today, they ruled 23 of the 29 public schools going to be shut down. And you go, well, what's going to happen to those schools once they're shut down? Oh, the real estate deals. Oh, the privateers. Oh, there'll be charters. There'll be, who knows? Who knows what the wealth class has in store for the children of Philadelphia? I know what they want. They want profit. They want control. And, well, looks like that's what they're getting. We're going to talk about that. Also, minimum wage back on the minds of politicians. And I got to be honest, I'm glad to see that at least some Democrats have grown a spine and taking it seriously. The president upset me, $9 an hour. Just really, you caved in on your own $9.50 from just a year ago. Already talking yourself down before you got to the negotiating table. Some Democrats have proposed legislation raising it up to $10.10 an hour, which is, you know, right about where I think it should be. The minimum wage should be what the minimum to live is, not the minimum that we can exploit people at. Just a quick thought. Also, the great divide continues as the, well, the wealthy, they get filthy rich, and the rest of us, well, not. Also going to talk about, not surprisingly, contrary to Republican rhetoric, Americans are not all that thrilled with the hatchet job that austerity has brought us. They're not demanding deep and horrible cuts. What the American people want, they want their nation not to be looted and gutted. They want some investment. They want something for the future to give their children. I believe that's pretty common. Also going to talk about more fun with guns. And the more this is in the news, the more fun stuff keeps coming out. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I've got a bunch of interesting emails about the J1 students. Most of them, and this is what makes me happy. When people get it, when the light bulb goes on, and they go, whoa, we can't allow this to happen in our backyard. And, you know, people reassuring me that the woman that I met in the restaurant who said she didn't care, not indicative of everybody. Maybe just one total big flaming you-know-what. Most people said, look, you know, at the end of the day, those jobs, the position I've taken, those jobs should pay a decent, reasonable wage. What has frustrated me, though, is I look at the response from the township where these kids resided in the basement of this house. That evidently, a manager lived in the upper floors. The basement was locked off. 8-9 people living in this basement. The township manager. And this just blows my mind. Evidently, this morning was the first that he had heard that something had happened in his town. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't think Hampton Township is all that big. We're not talking buzzing metropolis. We're not talking about a huge news cycle. When 50 people show up at a McDonald's and it gets all of the local news and it hits the newspapers, you would think that someone who's up on what's going on in their community would know that. But he says, you know, him and his staff, they're going to look into the matter, see if there were any violations of the ordinances. I don't know, but, you know, maybe it's just me, but I think there's got to be something against 8 or 9 people living in a basement and renting space like that. There's just got to be something. Just a thought. He said that he would notify the property or owners in a timely manner and that he wasn't going to be able to predict, because they don't have a crystal ball, evidently, what's going to go on. So we don't know. We're not going to predict. What I would have said, and maybe this is just a different way of phrasing it, maybe he's a truly caring human being who cares about these kids and cares about the future of his community. I would have said, look, if the allegations are true, I'm appalled, and my staff is going to work day and night to get to the bottom of it and make sure it doesn't happen in our community again. That's just a different way of looking at it, I guess. And, you know, as I talked to some of the students in the aftermath of what happened yesterday, I was not surprised that, you know, one of the police departments took a very, and maybe it was just this one officer, took a very anti-worker position. siding with the homeowner going, well, you know, it's their house, we're causing disruption. These kids are trying to get back into their dwelling. And I look at this and I go, you know, in our country, right under our noses. And I had an opportunity to speak with, because a lot of the kids came by the studio here today. Follow up and see our operation and you know, have a couple more in-depth conversations. And one of the questions that I asked is, why Central Pennsylvania? Of all the places in this country that you wanted to go, what drew you here? And, you know, the stories ranged. Most of them said, hey, you know, you're close to New York, you're close to Washington, close to Philadelphia, you know, close to Boston. You're centrally located to all of these places that we wanted to visit. We wanted to see what we had learned in the history books. We wanted to see, you know, the land of the American Revolution, the land of the American spirit. We wanted to see that firsthand. And silly them. They actually thought that we had a functional public transportation system that would get them to those places at a reasonable cost and reasonably quickly. Silly them. And, you know, a lot of this could be attributed to silly them. They believed the rhetoric more than the actual facts. They believed that this was the shining hill on the shining star on the hill. They believed this was the land of opportunity, the land of hope and dreams. And they came here because they wanted it. And I got to be honest, as I talk to these kids, that American spirit of we're not going to take it, that American spirit of, you know, get outraged, came out in these kids. Saying, no, we're not going to put up with it. We're going to stand up, we're going to fight back, and we're going to make it better, not just for ourselves, but for the people after us. And not just for the people after us, but for the people who live here. And when the Hershey thing was going on, I was struck by how all of these kids said, look, these are jobs that should be paying a livable wage done by people in the community to support their families. This isn't something I should be paying thousands of dollars to come halfway around the world for a cultural exchange to end up in a warehouse. And we were talking about some of the other jobs that they were offered. And, you know, some of them you go, well, yeah, I understand. The one kid said he could have gone to Maine to work at a ski resort. And I go, I understand that. That seems like a reasonable kind of exchange because you're going to have, you know, tourists coming through. You're going to be able to interact. And there's going to maybe, unless you're the one scrubbing the toilets, and I don't know what the job is. But as I talked to these kids, the contracts that they signed were very specific. And, you know, I like I said yesterday, I don't often read the comment sections of the newspapers. But it blew my mind at some of the idiocracy, just some of the idiocy that just pervasive in the comment section. Well, they should have read their contract. Well, these kids did read their contracts and did have people read them for them. It's just that our people, the way it looks, broke the contract. And when I saw the manager, his reaction, you go, you know, this is a culture of exploitation. You know, this is a culture of domination and harassment. Because that guy, to me, looked like a thug. Looked like a bully. Specifically to keep those people in line. And it's just, you know, I'm hoping in the coming days, weeks, and months, we see an investigation. I understand the Department of Labor is looking into it. You've got the Department of State looking into it. They're the folks who evidently are the ones who are supposed to be overseeing the J-1 visa exchange visitor program. And, of course, you know, this host organization, GeoVisions. And I would like to know if there's any of the same bad actors from the last time in Hershey with this company. But the bigger question for me then becomes, how pervasive is this? Because, you know, as I walked around and I looked at the place where these kids lived, it's my neighborhood, man. That's where any one of our kids could be growing up. Having that kind of exploitation right in our, what does that do for us as a nation? What does it do for our soul? And they interviewed the guy, and it was one of the questions I had yesterday. One of the guys who lived, the guy who lives next door to this house, and he said, "Look, you know, the setup's disruptive. You can't sleep. The workers are coming and going at all hours of the night. It's a bad setup." And my first thought is, "Well, why didn't you say anything? If you see this kind of, and what is that about us? You know, I understand that. Hey, I'm going to keep my head down. I'm not going to get involved. I kind of get that." But the exploitation that's going on could be you. And that's where I think class consciousness has to come into play at some point. It really absolutely has to be part of this. So that when you see an injustice, when you see something wrong, you say, you know what? We're not going to put up with it. Because the Hampton Township manager, he said, "Well, we've never had any complaints. Nobody ever told us anything." Well, they're telling you now. And my question, then I got thousands of questions on this. How long has this been going back? How long has this been going on? How many other companies in the area? And the last time, we had a number of people who emailed me and said, "Well, you know, there's this place over here, and there's this place over here. We know that they're using them and exploiting these students." And, you know, this isn't a cheap labor program. This is supposed to be a cultural exchange to help the next generation of leaders in other countries have an appreciation for our country. I know a lot of people don't think that that's important, but it is. These kids are little American ambassadors when they go home, good or bad. So when they go home and their friends go, "Hey, how was America?" What story do you want them to tell? What story when they get back to their local community and the local newspaper says, "Oh, you spent 4 months in the U.S. What was it like?" And they say, "Well, we were locked in a basement. We worked, 25-hour shift at the local McDonald's handing food through a window to uncaring, glassy-eyed patrons who were just driving through on the treadmill." Kind of makes you wonder. It kind of makes me angry. And I think it should make you angry, too. Right in our community, underneath our noses, they're allowed to get away with this. And for me, it's just more of the privatization train. It's more of the cutting of government oversight. It's more of the gutting of regulation. But I guess if we're not going to oversee Wall Street, we're not going to put regulators on Wall Street and rein them in, why would we rein this in? I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the Philadelphia School District, what's going on there, a new piece of legislation going to be introduced on charters and cyber schools. When we get back, stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
On June 25th, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The recent tragic and brutal murder of Federal Corrections Officer Eric Williams at the U.S. Penitentiary in Canaan, Pennsylvania, is the direct result of dangerous understaffing in the federal prison system. That's according to the Council of Prison Locals Union, an affiliate of the American Federation of Government Employees. Dale Desotel is president of the Council of Prison Locals. He says given the already dangerous understaffing, the sequestration cuts will have a literal life and death impact on thousands of corrections officers.
Now if you go to sequestration, where we remove another 10 to 20% of the staff from each shift or from that institution at any particular time between now and October 1st, schedules will be changed, people's lives will be changed, and we put more in danger because there'll be less people to respond.
Desotel says federal workers have already been hit with $103 billion in concessions, including pay freezes for 2 years and cuts in pensions. His Council of Prison Locals and AFGE wants Congress to recognize the dangers of prison understaffing and to do something to correct the problem, because understaffing and overcrowding in federal prisons is a prescription for disaster.
Whatever Congress does, whether they do taxes or close loopholes, we don't even have a budget. So at least give us a budget to where we can function at the same levels of last year or what have you. To try to enforce the sequester this year perhaps was too big of a bite for the entire government to try to consume in 1 year.
Now with more labor news, here's Jesse Russell.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What keeps you up at night, Governor? What part of all of those worries concerns you the most? The cuts, the tax
hikes? Well, usually I wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I wonder where we are going to balance the budget. We have a pension crisis just like every other state just about has a pension
right, but
crisis.
You've had that success. I want our viewers to know you've balanced 2 previous budgets, if not more. Right. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you've closed deficit holes of more than $4 billion. You've had success.
Yeah, you've had success. And again, I go back, every time I hear that, I go back to what's your definition of success? Balance the budget off the backs of those least able to defend themselves, the poor, the elderly, children. Yeah, I mean, if I can kick somebody while they're down, sure, I'm going to do well too, right? At least that's the way I see it. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So today there was a meeting in Philadelphia to decide, you know, how many of these 29 schools that were on the chopping block are going to be shuttered. Looks like 23 are going to be closed. And before the meeting, during the meeting, the president of the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten, along with 18 others, I believe, was arrested and taken, carted away. Why? Well, you want to make sure that those kids have schools to go to. Just mind-blowing. Here to talk to us about his proposed legislation, I've got Representative James Rohrbuck. James, thanks for taking time for me.
Hello, how are you?
I am good. You know, I look at this situation in Philadelphia, and I go, you know, as this goes there, it's coming to my neck of the woods as we change over from a public school system to a very private one. I don't see the good in it.
I would agree with you. I think what's happened in Philadelphia is that there's been a movement of large numbers of students out of the traditional public schools into charters, and the end result is that the public schools find themselves with too few students in buildings, and the reality has become that you have the need to shut down buildings that are now just way too big for the number of students they have. So it's a real crisis, and it's the process itself has been distorted because there's been an effort because of the financial pressures on the Philadelphia School District to do this in 1 year when it's a much more deliberative process. You need to really do things and think them out and think about the consequences. When you start talking about having students travel over larger and larger distances to get to school, especially when you're dealing with very young kids, very young children, then you have serious, serious issues in an urban setting.
Yeah, and beyond that, you know, I look at this whole divide and conquer strategy, and this really is what it is. They're dividing up, and the laws in this state have been so badly skewed in favor of charters and these, especially the cyber schools, that, you know, it's going to destroy our brick and mortar public schools. And look, I understand a lot of the charter schools are still considered public schools, but I don't see it that way. I don't see when there's an appointed board running the charter school and that there's very little local control. I don't see that really as a public school. I see that as a public finance school that the community has very little oversight over. I see it that way. Or am I missing something?
No, I think you're right. I think charter schools are supposed to be public schools, but even the legislature, the way it approaches it, regards them as being something different. For example, we just did a legislation on teacher accountability, teacher evaluation in the House. And when the bill was debated on the House floor, it was made clear that the bill would apply only to brick and mortar traditional public schools, that charters and cyber charters were excluded from the evaluation process. Well, the reality is they are supposed to be public schools.
Yep.
So why do you write a law that says this applies to all public schools except charters and cyber charters?
Because let's get down to the brass tacks. I mean, the reality of this is this whole movement is to privatize and put into the hands of the very wealthy our education system. One for profit and two for message, so that they have the control of everything that is being taught to our kids. And, you know, I point to Florida State University, and I don't know if you've seen this story, but the Koch brothers give Florida State University a small amount of money, like $2 million. And for that $2 million, they have veto power over any economics professor hired there. That's massive control. And now you bring that model down to the K-12 years of education to have that kind of control of the curriculum in front of my kid. That is ultimate power.
Well, and it's ultimately wrong. I mean, it's not what public education is supposed to be about. And if we allow that to continue, then the fault is on us.
Yep,
and we ought to be held accountable for that.
Yeah, I've said this is the hill that the working class of this country has to die on, because past generations fought, bled, and died too much to get this right, that every kid has an opportunity to get a good education.
Absolutely, I think that's an absolute, and it's you know, we talk a lot about things that are in the Constitution. We talk about the rights of gun owners. Well, in the Constitution, it talks about a public school system and the kind of a system that provides a thorough and efficient system of education for every student. Now, if we're going to fight so hard over Second Amendment rights, we're going to be fighting equally hard over the rights of young people to have a public education.
I would argue you should be fighting more, because if you can't read the Second Amendment, you don't know what it is.
Yeah, that's a good point. You're absolutely right.
But, you know, here's the reason I asked you on is I understand that you're going to put forth some legislation to reform this charter school stuff, so that we are comparing apples and apples, and they're held accountable at the same level. If you're going to test one, you got to test the other, and then we compare them and say, okay, well, which one is doing better?
Absolutely. Well, the effort is to deal with some of the problems in the current way we do through education and level of the differences, and level the ground of differences, so that you'll have certainly charters and public schools, but they'll be competing on an equal basis, and there won't be greater weight given to the charters or exceptions given to the charters that allow them to function differently. Especially with public dollars.
Right, absolutely. Because here's my problem. And down in your neck of the woods down there in Philadelphia, you had the Frontier Virtual Cyber Charter School, and I'm sure you've heard of it.
Yes.
You know, all of those kids, there were some 54 kids that were going through that program who they've lost their education. I mean, those 5 years that they were going to that school, they got nothing really out of it. And at the end of it, all of those taxpayer dollars that just went up in smoke because they pulled the charter. What good did that do our society? In fact, it hurt the public schools even more, because those kids then went back to the public schools, had to be remediated, which costs even more.
Sure. And I think that, to be fair, we have a lot of charters in Philadelphia. And some of that, we have some innovative strong charters.
Not against that.
Are what they're supposed to be. They're supposed to be role models that can be replicated. And that's what we've forgotten. The charter school law talks about creating educational excellence that can be replicated. Well, the reality is we haven't done that. But the reality is that we ought to be about trying to ensure that whatever schools we have, whether they're traditional publics or charters, are doing an excellent job at educating our kids. And until we do that, then we aren't doing what we're supposed to do.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. You know, the reality is I want there to be innovation. I want there to be new opportunities. Personally, I'm a huge fan of the Montessori school method. There are so many different ways to do this, and I want that innovation, but I want it to be into the hands of us, of me, of we the people, not an appointed board, not a board of trustees, but actual people who are held accountable.
Sure. And we seem to be getting further and further away from that. We certainly thought that we don't have an elected school board. We have that elected school board, for now probably, 60 years. But certainly there is a sense that a school board is accountable to the people in the individual community, and they are responsible to them, and they're setting policies that affect the children in those communities. And that ought to be the model that we're using.
Yeah, because, you know, the people on that school board, they probably got kids of their own. And, you know, it's those schools that their kids go to. And I personally think that if you're going to serve on the school board, you should have kids in that school. For too long, I've seen these school boards co-opted by local business people who the only thing that they care about is, well, we're not going to raise taxes. We don't care what we have to do. We don't care what programs we cut. We don't care if kids get study hall all day long. We're not raising taxes.
Well, I think what we ought to be concerned about is that we educate young people so they can go out and be productive in society and can earn a decent living and support themselves as they go forward and improve our society. That's what I think we should be about.
I'm right there with you. But, you know, the thing is as I look at what's going on here in Harrisburg, our governor and the Republicans who are leading our state have cut our public education. It's now historically at the lowest level it's been since, I guess, public education, the amount of state money going in now. Am I right on this?
The amount we cut $1 billion out of the public education budget 2 years ago, and we haven't come close to restoring that. And we were on the road towards equalizing school funding among all the districts in the Commonwealth. We've abandoned that. We have no real formula for funding schools in this state. We're one of the three states that don't have a funding formula at this point. So I'm not sure what we're doing. It's just if the whole intent is do whatever you can to save money, it doesn't matter whether you have quality education or not.
Because in talking to a couple of the school board members that I know, they say that the amount of money that comes from the state into the school districts is at its, the percentage is at its lowest bit, and something like 15% now comes from the state, or some obscenely low number like that. And the rest comes from the local tax base, which you can only raise a certain percent. So as the state continues cutting funding, you can't even keep up by raising it in your local area if you wanted to.
There's been a steady decline of the state level support for public education. It used to be over half of the dollars came from the state. Now it's probably much, I know it's at least below 35, maybe 30%, so that burden falls back on individual taxpayers, and individual taxpayers are at the point of saying, well, if the taxes continue to go up, I'm going to lose my house. I'm going to lose my property. And so that leads to a pushback. So the reality is you need a better way of doing this.
Yes.
And certainly the whole issue with charters, which diverts money from the traditional public schools, makes the issue worse.
So let me ask you: should we be selling off the liquor store? Should we have booze for books or shots for tots? Should we be doing that? Is that how we're going
to
fund?
I do not support that. To me, that's a very poor option to say you sell the liquor stores to get money for education. Plus, it's a one chance shot. You do it once, and that's gone. And the revenue that we get from liquor sales is lost forever at that point. So I don't see the sense of that. It makes no sense to me whatsoever.
I gotta be honest with you, Representative.
One time fixes don't solve the problem. You need to fund education. That's a basic responsibility of state government. Yeah. If it means you have to raise taxes, you do that. But you do it in a way that is not going to cause people unnecessary distress, but you support the public education system. That's an obligation of state government.
But that's an obligation your colleagues on the other side of the aisle don't seem to share, because as I'm watching what they're doing, they're talking about, we're going to sell off the wine and spirit shops to fund education. We're going to hock off the lottery to fund senior programs. And, you know, when they had the hearing when the company from Great Britain wanted Camelot Global Services was testifying, something interesting came out of their CEO's mouth, in my opinion, which was in the UK, where they run the lottery over there, the revenue from the lottery goes towards, they funded the Olympics, they fund the arts, they fund humanities. Over there, it's for cultural betterment. For here, we use the funds for that to fund our most valuable resources, our most precious, you know, folks, our seniors. It makes no sense to me on so many levels.
Well, I think that probably our mistake was, when we created the lottery, we should have probably had used that to fund education. We didn't do that. And now we are in a situation where we're never going to change where the money goes. That's a political reality. So I don't know what source of revenue we create. I don't think it's one-time sale of assets of the state, but we need to find a steady source of revenue to support education that's not based upon taxing individual property.
So let's go back to your legislation, your proposed legislation. How do we help you get this through?
I think we help you get through by doing the necessary ground-level discussions about this, and talk about the fact that my proposal ultimately brings back about $365 million to school districts that they can use to offset their expenses for education. That is, by making charters more accountable, we don't overpay them, we don't give them discretionary funds, which they can do anything they want to do. We level the playing field. We don't affect the quality of education that charters provide, but we do make the system fairer, and we take back the excess funds and put it into the traditional public schools where the money should be.
Yeah, I'm with you, because I never understood why it is that we're paying a cyber charter school the same amount that we would pay a brick and mortar school when they don't have the same cost structure.
Well, that again, and the reality is, we don't even subject those schools to accountability from local school districts. The state has taken the responsibility of creating the cyber charter schools and approving them, and then the money is drawn out of the local school district. That needs to change.
Are there any of these, in your understanding, are there any of these cyber charter schools who have made AYP, who have excelled the way they were supposed to? Because the studies that I've seen put none of them as passing.
It's my understanding that almost all of them did not make the AYP, the annual yearly progress you're supposed to make. And if we look at what happened, was the Department of Education applied a different standard to the charters and cyber charters so they would look like they were doing better than they did.
Yep.
So there's been a level of dishonesty in even evaluating how charter schools are doing.
And now, is that the fault of the legislature? Or is
that's the fault of the Department of Education, which applied a different system of evaluation without any approval to do it.
Now, will your legislation, will that fix it?
I would hope that would address some of that, that and other bills that are coming forward would prevent that kind of deception in evaluating the performance of schools in Pennsylvania.
Because surely the Republicans, they can't be against honest competition on a level playing field, can they?
Well, I'm not certain, because as I said, we just did a bill about teacher evaluation. And the argument is that part of the problem is that you have too many teachers who are not performing at the level they should. Therefore, we need to tighten the way we evaluate teacher performance. When the bill was written and passed in the House, we specifically included all forms of public schools, charters, cyber charters, traditional publics, in the bill. That language is taken out in the Senate. But when we passed it out of the committee this year, we did the same thing. We applied it to all public schools, and then on the House floor, it was said, oh, well, in fact, it's not intended to apply to either charters or cyber charters. So we're creating different levels of even the way we apply a basic thing that we all say is necessary, having a better system evaluating teachers so we have better teachers in the classroom.
Right.
This makes no sense.
It doesn't make any sense. Let me ask you the last line of questioning I've got for you because, you know, as I look at this, what just blows my mind is what you have is all of this money going into this. And when I see the Bloombergs and I see the DeVoses and I see all of this billionaire money being thrown towards, you look at Los Angeles, for instance, they spent millions of dollars to try and elect a pro-voucher, pro-charter school board. Didn't work, fortunately, out there. But I see all of this money. Is there any way to say, look, money that we spend on public education, be it the public charters or the regular public schools, stays there. We're not paying huge dividends, huge rewards to these billionaires who are investing. And look, they didn't get to be rich by being stupid. They understand return on investment, and they're going to want their money back. And they're going to want it back with good interest. Is there anything that says, hey, you're not going to make a profit off of this because education is for the common good? Is there anything like that?
I'm not certain that will happen. I think, unfortunately, the way we've changed our political structure, we've opened up the door for those folks with lots of money to influence the process. I just went through a spring primary, and I'm an anti-voucher person, and I had a pro-voucher candidate against me, and the folks who were these same kinds of folks poured $500,000 into my opponent's campaign.
And I understand she's got some trouble now, if I understand this right.
Well, I don't know that to be true, but I know that, you know, you find yourself suddenly being just inundated with unbelievable amounts of money. And that I think that distorts the whole political process.
Yep.
It's not about, you know, a level playing field anymore. It's about who can put the most money on the table and in my case, I won, and I won actually by 11 points, but and you have the same thing happening in Los Angeles, but it distorts the actual process, the actual political process, when you use money in that way to try and influence a political result.
Yeah, which is why we've got to get money out of the politic and also out of education, in my view. Representative Roebuck, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity of getting told with you. Take care.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Uh-oh. You always have to worry when you hear that there's, quote, a new air of giddiness on Wall Street. That's a sure sign that financial disaster is looming on our horizon again. After all, giddy is a synonym for feather-brained, frivolous, foolish. This latest outbreak of what was once called irrational exuberance among financial titans has been sparked by a sudden splurge on corporate mergers. In just the past 4 months, a dozen supersized corporate takeovers have siphoned off between $3 billion and $24 billion each in capital, money dumped into frothy deals that create nothing. Why are they done? Follow the money. First, such financial giants as J.P. Morgan Chase constantly push mergers because bankers pocket a fortune in fees for packaging and financing the buyouts. Second, since CEOs have drastically whacked jobs and wages the past few years while also inflating their stock prices, they've now got trillions of dollars in cash they need to move. How about investing in more employees, better service, or improved products? Nah, it's easier and flashier just to buy up competitors, swell their fiefdoms, and get mega kudos for boldness. Third, the biggest private equity buyout firms are also sitting on mountains of cash they accumulated from speculators before the 2008 crash. Hundreds of billions of these speculator dollars, known as dry powder, have to be invested by the end of this year. So the rush is on for them to snap up corporations, whack as many jobs as possible, sell off or shut down segments of the business, then cash in for themselves and the speculators. This is Jim Hightower saying, one Wall Street economist says, giddily, that today's urge to merge is, quote, a sign that corporate America believes that the economic expansion is going to accelerate. Yeah, and run right over us.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
We need to stand united, undivided, we shall never fall. Remember all, we need to trust in and then forever call. Our brothers and our sisters, and are you and I aware? You and I both know that we can't rely on it. The time is trying, plans are lining, no mistaking. For union resurrection, the anger has awakened. Has awakened the sleeping giant. Come on, now we can do it. We need to revive, react, and re-up the labor movement.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey unveiled his plan yesterday to make sure that kids across the Commonwealth and across the country have access to early childhood education. And if you remember the President's State of the Union address, he talked about, yeah, we need to develop a program that all 3- and 4-year-olds get some form of education before they get to kindergarten. I guess he didn't know that in Pennsylvania, kindergarten isn't mandatory. I think that would be a first step. Let's make that at least mandatory. Because I remember here in Harrisburg where they were saying, well, you know, maybe we'll do away with that. And again, this is one of those moments where you look at the charter schools and the public schools. Public schools, not mandated. So the school district said, well, we're not going to provide transportation for those kids in the public school to go to kindergarten. But you can still get them there if you want. But the charter schools, different rules. The school district has to provide them with transportation. And I would say instead of taking it away from the charters, why not make sure that everyone gets it? And, you know, when the president said that, you know, we should have early childhood education, remember the woman from Fox News?
I have to tell you, I think it's immoral to make all these promises when you know at the end of the day you can't afford it, we can't afford it, to say preschool for everybody. Are you kidding me? We don't have the money for that.
No, we don't have the money for that. We're broke, remember? Except we can give oil company millions of dollars. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. I got Stosh on line one. Stosh, how are you?
Hey, Rick, what's going on?
I haven't heard from you in a while. What's been happening?
I've been listening, but I just haven't been participating. But I have an idea.
Hit me.
Now, they want to bring in the Keno.
Yep.
I would like to have an amendment to the Pennsylvania lottery where the Keno money is designated only for public schools, not private schools, not charter schools, not Catholic schools, but public schools only.
I got a better idea, Stosh.
Yeah.
Why don't we fund education? Why do we have to do it on vice spending? Why don't we budget what we're going to spend on our children? Why don't we budget what we're going to spend on our seniors and make sure that we have the money available? Prioritize those things over tax breaks for corporations, over keeping the Delaware loophole open, over making sure that the drillers who are coming here raping our land get away scot-free. Why don't we prioritize education and programs for our seniors and you maybe use that vice money to enrich our society for better things, for like they do in the UK, for the humanities, for the arts, for the Olympics. That's what we should be using vice spending for. Just my thought there, Stosh.
I understand that, but they're not listening. They don't want to do that. They're not closing the loophole. So this is one thing we should do for ourselves. If they push it that way, they don't want to close the loopholes. They don't want to fund education North kind of way. They want to bring more revenue to the state. Keno, they're going to push Keno, make an amendment where Keno is definitely for public schools only.
Well, I'll go with you on making sure the money goes to us. But here, understand, when they wanted to privatize the lottery, and they're still pushing for it, that money that was going to go to Keno was going to go for profit. You know better than that. You know how this game is rigged.
Well, that's just my thought.
It is, and it's a good one.
Thought.
And it's great to hear from you.
It's good to be back.
All right. Thanks so much, Stosh. No, I mean, you know, to me, you know, why aren't we just funding education as a matter of course? Saying, look, hey, we're going to fund education because it's the right thing to do. It's an investment in the future of our country. The kids who are in kindergarten, first, second, third grade, all through, these are the kids who are going to take care of me when I'm old. These are the kids that I'm going to have to rely on to make the decisions of the future. All of the bad decisions that we've made over the years, I'm hoping the next generation goes, you people are screwed up. We've got to dig out. We've got to fix what you've done, and we're never going to let it happen again. Just a thought. And to me, education starts, and this is why I like Casey. There's a lot of things I'm not fond of, but I like Casey, this idea that we need to invest in education. And his bill that he's going to introduce, I guess it was formally introduced, he'll do it later in the week, I guess, maybe tomorrow. It's called Prepare All Kids Act. The idea is to provide pre-kindergarten education with some federal money to states that they would able to then match. The idea is to establish, enhance, or expand these states' pre-K programs so that, you know what, they get a shot. And I look at my kids, all of my kids, and it's just because I'm fortunate. Most working families aren't as fortunate, and I don't think it should be how much money you bring in that your kids get a shot. I think it should be all kids, every one, because every one of those kids is an investment in our future. And I like the fact that his legislation is going to put a cap on the number of kids in these programs at 20. I'd like to see a little lower, but, you know, 20 is a start. Because what I don't want to end up having is you end up warehousing these kids. And then it just becomes it's just a warehouse. Now, Casey understands, you know, it's going to be tough finding the funding. He said we're going to maybe start off a little small and hopefully it expands. But you got to look at the political landscape. This is not a bipartisan issue. The Republicans don't seem to really care about education. And all I have to do is look at what our governor here has done. I look at what governors across this country have done. And it's cut, cut, cut. Especially education. And when Casey pointed out, he said, you know what, only 17% of 3- and 4-year-olds in Pennsylvania get some form of early childhood education. 17%. And in other states, it's even lower than that. Think about that for a second. 17%. And you go, well, you know, those are the, you know, how many working class families can afford? I mean, my wife and I, it's like $350 a month for our 4-year-old to go to a pre-K program. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money for working families. But should my kid get that kind of a benefit because I can afford it and yours not because you can't? It's just, you know, I think it's flat wrong. And, you know, while Casey and Obama are saying, hey, we need to invest in this, you've now got the money part of it. Republicans don't want any part of it. And you look at the other end of the spectrum, you know, kindergarten's one thing. Look at college. Look at what we've done to colleges in this country. The average cost of tuition has gone up. Now it's an all-time high. It went up, what, 8.5%, almost 8.5% in 2011, 2012. And the funding, and this is, again, it's that X, it's that inverse, it's that negative relationship. As the tuition costs go up, our funding goes down. In fact, state and local funding for operating expenses, for research, student aid fell 9%. So up by 8.3 and funding fell. So you're talking about over a 17% increase in costs to the student. Because, of course, the cost went up and that help went away. And you go, is that good for us? And the answer is no. This is horrible for our country. To have this kind of a lack of investment and have these kids take on this kind of massive debt. You've seen, well, it was this past year, hit $1 trillion in student loan debt. You're talking about this massive bubble. And oh, by the way, did you know student loan debt can't be discharged? Look what we've done to these kids. Look what we've done. We've said, well, we'll give you all the money you want. You can go, because the only way you're going to get a middle-class job, the only way you're going to have a middle-class existence in this country, you go to college. In fact, they were telling me that when I was a kid. That's going to be the only way. You're not going to be a working person anymore. You're going to be someone who's got to have a college degree, or you're going to be the working poor. And I go back to these J-1 students who came here because they wanted to experience the American experiment. They wanted to see the American dream. And what they found was the American nightmare of low-wage work. What they found is what the average low-waged worker in this country toils through every day. The kind of exploitation, the kind of harassment, the kind of intimidation. The one girl said they made me work 25 hours. And you go, that happens to American workers too. And you look at the fact that, you know the guy who owns these chains locally? You know he's sitting pretty. You know he lives in the nice big house in the gated community. You know he's well taken care of. And who did he make his money off of? The low-wage worker. The one who is easiest to exploit. Because they couldn't get the loans. They couldn't go to college. They didn't have the ability. Because the money is dried up. And it's infuriating. Because, you know, when I talk to these kids, a lot of them come from countries like Paraguay and Argentina and Brazil. And yet in their countries, higher education is free. Free. Think about that for a second. Because in that country, in those countries, they understand the next generation, that investment that they make in the future is oh so important. Here in this country, all we care about is training little worker bees who will push the buttons, who will shuffle the papers, and never bring their head up and ask why. And you look at the fact that all of the productivity gains over the years, and productivity has gone up, what was the number I saw? 254% since 1948. So you've seen productivity rise by 254%. The hourly compensation rate only rose by 113%. Where did that 141% between the compensation and the productivity, where did that income go? Where did that wealth go? Where did all of that money go? Well, you know where it went. It went to the guy who owns that chain of McDonald's. It went to the guy who's sitting in the corner office. It went to the very top of the economic chain. And why has it been allowed to happen? Because we've allowed corporations to break unions. And it's really very simple. And you can see a very simple graph. In fact, CNN Money has it over on their website, which lays this out in the starkest of terms. From the end of World War II up until about 1977, as productivity went up, wages went with it. They stayed right there. They were overlapping each other. As workers worked harder, as workers worked more efficient, as workers were more productive, their wages went up. Their share of the wealth that they created went up. And guess what else happened? They spent that money in the local economy, which created more jobs, which is why we had this strong, burgeoning middle class. So around 1977, 78, that began to uncouple. The assault on organized labor, the assault on workers, the assault on labor laws, full head underway. In comes Ronald Reagan, and man, it accelerates. Productivity's continually going up. Wages have now flatlined. So from 1978 until now, you see a constant, steady, upward trajectory of productivity. Wages, flat, and actually declining. And I go back to when I first started into the workforce, my first actual adult job, if you will. I had a bunch of, I worked at, a fast food place. I worked as a security guard. I worked a lot of those odd jobs. My first, this is my job, this is my career job. I started out as a casual throwing boxes on a shipping dock, making $15 an hour in 1989. $15 an hour up to 18, I think it was 1890 at the time. Today, doing that exact job, here 24 years later, $10-$12 an hour. No benefits, no health care, no pension, nothing. Think about that. Where did that productivity, did it take longer to load a truck now than it did then? No. What happened? Well, what happened is the companies have taken that for themselves, and they've pocketed that for themselves. You and I have been robbed repeatedly. Our labor has been taken from us repeatedly. And I love hearing these idiots like Rand Paul, and we're going to talk a little later in the program about Rand Paul's rant yesterday on the drones, which I agree with him on the drones thing. As soon as he started going into the Lochner stuff, he lost me, telling me just how crazy the right is, this whole liberty of contract thing, which sounds just fantastic, until you start throwing in the idea that, you know what? You can be exploited. And I look at these kids in this J1 program. Is this the nation we want? And what are we going to do to take it back? What are we going to do what my grandparents did? What are we willing to do to make sure that the wealth that we create, we actually get? So that we bring that compensation back to productivity. You know, and this is the thing that the right has absolutely wrong. Union workers want to work. They just want to be paid for the work that they do. It's that simple. Union workers are some of the most efficient, some of the most productive. And you know what? They demand some of what they create. And I think that should be all workers. Everybody should demand their worth. I'm going to take a quick break when we come back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the top.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
The steel strike of 1919 was called the Hunky Strike because most of the workers were either first or second generation immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe. Up until the end of World War I, workers had benefited from shorter hours, better pay, and the promise of union recognition. Once the war came to an end, the mill owners pursued anti-union open shop policies and other cost-cutting measures. During the strike, there was near total suppression of all civil liberties. Major work issues included the 12-hour day, the 7-day work week, scores of workers being injured and maimed, union recognition, and poverty wages. Mary Harris, better known as Mother Jones, fought tirelessly throughout her life for social justice and human rights as a labor leader and a worker advocate. On August 20th, while visiting striking miners in Homestead, Pennsylvania, home of U.S. Steel's famous Homestead Steelworks, she defied injunctions against public gatherings and addressed 5,000 striking workers and their families. This speech led to her being arrested and jailed for giving an unauthorized speech. When brought before the judge, she was asked who had signed a permit to speak at a public gathering. She answered, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As the strike went on, Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, gave many speeches to rally the workers. One speech in Chicago was described by a spy for the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division as the foulest and most profane that can be imagined, teeming with ultra-radical suggestions. Welcoming the spies, she would invite them to the front of the crowd so they could report her words accurately. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by Grafton Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The recent tragic and brutal murder of Federal Corrections Officer Eric Williams at the U.S. Penitentiary in Canaan, Pennsylvania, is the direct result of dangerous understaffing in the federal prison system. That's according to the Council of Prison Locals Union, an affiliate of the American Federation of Government Employees. Dale Desotel is president of the Council of Prison Locals. He says given the already dangerous understaffing, the sequestration cuts will have a literal life and death impact on thousands of corrections officers.
Now if we go to sequestration, where we remove another 10 to 20% of the staff from each shift or from the institution at any particular time between now and October 1st, schedules will be changed, people's lives will be changed, and we put more in danger because there'll be less people to respond.
Desotel says federal workers have already been hit with $103 billion in concessions, including pay freezes for 2 years and cuts in pensions. His Council of Prison Locals and AFGE wants Congress to recognize the dangers of prison understaffing and to do something to correct the problem, because understaffing and overcrowding in federal prisons is a prescription for disaster.
Whatever Congress does, whether they do taxes or close loopholes, we don't even have a budget. So at least give us a budget to where we can function at the same levels of last year or what have you. To try to enforce the sequester this year perhaps was too big of a bite for the entire government to try to consume in 1 year.
Now with more labor news, here's Jesse Russell.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
In the end, Wall Street, with Obama, Duncan, Bloomberg, Walcott, and Goldstein as its agents, they once turned public education into private profitable businesses. They hope to impose factory regime of managerial control over educators' working conditions and our students, our children's learning conditions.
All right, well, that's about it. You know, you look at, I don't know how else you can put it, the guy's spot on. You know, that's the goal. Privatize public education, this factory mentality, kids are just empty vessels that you pour knowledge into their heads, grill and drill. We're not training critical thinkers, we're not training leaders, we're training little robots. And education in this country is about how to get a job for somebody and not how to be a productive citizen, which I do think there is a huge difference. Today there was a big meeting in Philadelphia to decide how many of the public schools they're going to close, you know, as this shift continues, as the moneyed interests push for more charters, push for more private money. The public schools are going to be left abandoned. And this is the reason I think it's important to hear in this area is it's coming across the state. This is just the model. One of the people at the meeting today, a guy named Jesse Braxton, he is the education organizer at Action United, actionunited.org, the website. Jesse, thanks for taking time for me.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
So tell me what happened today at the meeting. I understand there were 29 schools potentially that could have been closed.
Yeah, there were 29 schools on the list. Only 27 of those were being voted on today. And this is at the end of a long closure process here. Originally, there were going to be 37, and several of them were taken off the list after lots of protests by the community. And tonight they spared a few more, but still in the end voted to close 23 schools, 23 public neighborhood schools in Philadelphia.
And where are those kids going to end up going? I mean, I remember when I was a kid, the big thing, back in the 70s was busing, and they shipped kids all over the place, 2 hours to the other side of town, to gain some kind of, diversity numbers. It seems now that we're just closing school. Where are we putting these kids?
Yeah, well, they're putting them in other buildings. There are buildings that have capacity for them to put these students in, but they're not necessarily in their neighborhoods. They only provide busing if you live more than a mile and a half away from your school. So we're talking about having some children that are walking up to a mile and a half. You know, we're talking 5 and 6 year olds having to go really far just to get to their closest neighborhood school.
Well, that's not really your neighborhood then, is it?
It's really not your neighborhood, yeah, and sometimes there are turf lines there. They're dangerous neighborhoods. There's lots of crime activity and sex offenders that live in the area. It's a really bad situation. It's a really bad situation for those unfortunate children.
Well, to be honest, the whole situation there in Philadelphia with education is, as a whole, to me, seems to be really bad because it doesn't seem like there's – well, it seems like there's a clear direction, and it's towards profitizing education and destroying what is ours.
Yeah, no question about it. That's what's going on. You know, the majority of the school buildings that have gotten closed in the past have usually been reopened as charters. There's a lot of moneyed interest behind that. You know, people looking to make a profit off of privatizing some piece of public education. Public education in the U.S. is a $3 trillion a year business. There's a lot of people that are looking to find ways to get their hands on some of that money.
Yeah.
And so we see this sweeping the country. You know, just a couple months ago, we were part of a group that went down to Washington, D.C. to meet with Secretary of Education Arne Duncan. There were 14 cities that have filed civil rights complaints saying that school closures are taking place in a way that disproportionately impacts people of color, disabled students, and English language learners. And this is happening all over the country right now. And so Philadelphia, we're not isolated in this struggle at all. And there's actually a growing movement across the country to fight back and to really push back for the kind of quality education system that we, you know, we really need in this country.
Now, I mean, when I hear this, that we don't have the money, and I remember right after the president, in his State of the Union address, said that we were going to have pre-K programs, we were going to pursue that. The next day, fake news on Fox had one of their talking head pundits. She said this.
I have to tell you, I think it's immoral to make all these promises when you know at the end of the day you can't afford it. You can't afford it. To say preschool for everybody, are you kidding me? We don't have the money for that.
And we don't have the money for that. And I see people like Mike Bloomberg giving $1 million to campaigns for school boards in Los Angeles, and I see all of this big money poured into politics on being able to take over our education. I go, we've got the money. We just don't have the political will or the political power yet to do it.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, we live in the richest country in the world. We have the money to put wherever we need to put it, you know, as long as we have political will to get it there. And that's what's lacking. You know, the low income folks that tend to send their children to public schools don't have a lot of political power in this country.
Yep.
You know, and that's a problem in and of itself that needs to be talked about and fixed. But so the services that they rely on, like public education, are under attack. So we're seeing that in a lot of different sectors, not just in education. You know, there was a threat to close libraries and rec centers and even fire stations in Philadelphia. We have fire stations that are being what they call browned out. You know, all of these services that working people rely on are being taken away because of this all this rage about austerity, saying that we don't have enough money. And we all know that's not true, you know, that is not the case at all. It's a big lie that's being put out there by the wealthy that don't want to pay their fair share.
And what we're seeing is, for whatever your thoughts on John Edwards is or was, you know, when he was running for president talking about the two Americas, this is what we're talking about. Very stark differences in services and education opportunities. And during the break, my producer said that to ask about the Germantown school. And I immediately asked, I said, Germantown Academy? And he goes, no. Germantown School,
mm-hmm.
Because I know Germantown Academy, to send your kid to a pre-K program to Germantown Academy is almost $20,000. To send your kid to high school there is over $30,000. And I go, we've got the money. We just don't seem to have the political will to make sure that everyone has the same opportunity.
Yeah, and I think this is a big issue, you know, not just for folks who have their children in public school right now, but when we're talking about what kind of city is Philadelphia going to be and cities across the country, you know, is it going to be a city that works for everybody? That includes, you know, people in the middle class. That includes people that have pretty well-paying professional jobs. You know, a lot of people are deciding to pull their children out of urban school districts and send them to these really high-priced private schools because the state of urban education is just so bad right now. There's been such a pattern of disinvestment and misinvestment and underinvestment in public schools that anybody that can find a way out has taken it. And that's a big problem. You know, if we want Philadelphia to be a really vibrant city and other cities across the state and across the country, we need to provide public education systems that are attractive, that are pulling people into the city, not driving people out.
Absolutely. And, you know, the thing that gets me is, you know, you see all of these schemes that they keep coming up with. Earlier I mentioned, you know, when I was a kid in the 70s, busing was the scheme. And then the Edison people in Philadelphia thought they could take over and privatize. It's all of these silver bullets that keep draining assets. And at the end end of the day don't work and screw another generation of kids. You don't see that kind of, let's throw something against the wall and see what sticks when you're talking about the Germantown Academies or the Laboratory School in Chicago or any of these really affluent schools. They know how to educate kids. It takes time, it takes money, and it takes small class sizes. There's an awful lot to this, and we evidently don't seem to want to do it for those people.
Yeah, it's not a mystery. It's not a mystery how you make education work. You know, we've been educating people very effectively in this country for a very, very long time. It's just, as you were saying, it's the question about the political will to put the funding behind it. That's the one thing that has never been tried in a city like Philadelphia, is adequately funding public education. And you know, there just isn't the political will to put that together. You know, that's why we organized. That's, you know, earlier today we had a rally of, I don't know how many hundreds of people were out there in front of the school district building before this vote on closures. We, you know, even had the president of the national, the American Federation of Teachers, one of the big national teachers unions, who got arrested in an act of civil disobedience earlier tonight. You know, because we need to come together, we need to organize, and we need to change the system. That's the only way that it's ever going to happen, to build the political will to have good schools in a city like Philadelphia.
Well, let me ask you, Jesse, because, you know, most of our listeners are not in Philadelphia, and they're saying, well, that's just a Philadelphia problem. That's just an urban problem. And if you go back to the 2012 presidential election, you saw in very stark terms that the Republicans, in fact, it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was Paul Ryan saying we lost because of the urbans. And the same thing, you know, came out of Romney's mouth. It's those people that Obama's giving things to, you know, like preschool. That cost him the election. Do you see that there's a divide? And what do you say to people in the center part of the state who say, well, no, that's a Philadelphia problem. That can't happen here.
Yeah, I will say that I think probably people that live in the center of the state are seeing some similar problems. You know, we have dozens of districts across the state right now that are financially distressed, especially after our governor's big budget cuts over the last couple of years. You know, Philadelphia is not the only city in this situation. School districts across the state are underfunded. Class sizes are going up. You know, this is happening all over the place. And we're going to win it together. You know, that's the way that we're going to win it. And if people think that it's just a Philadelphia problem, or if it's just, whatever your small town is in the middle of Pennsylvania or wherever you live, you know, if we allow ourselves to be divided that way, we're going to continue to see educational opportunities erode for everybody across the state. So, and the only way that we win it is by doing it together.
So how do we do that?
You know, I think we need to start talking to each other. I think we need to start talking to each other about, you know, what are the issues that we're facing. You know, there are suburban districts around us that are also struggling. The Chester Upland School District is right near Philadelphia, is also in a huge state of distress, and has been managed by the state of Pennsylvania, just like Philadelphia has been. I know schools in Harrisburg have lost a lot of money. You know, this is happening all over the place. We need to start getting together face to face and start talking about these problems. You know, there's a budget fight coming up, and Corbett is vulnerable, and he knows, I think, that he needs to put more money into education if he's going to win re-election. We need to make this the biggest issue of his reelection campaign. And the way that we do that is by getting together and coordinating our actions. You know, let's get people coming from all over the state and going down to the Capitol building and having a big rally for education funding. Let's coordinate something like that. And that's the work that we're going to begin to focus on as we move forward.
And not only that, but make sure we have a whole bunch of small demonstrations at every district office across the state. Every legislator, somebody, when he shows up at his home district, there are people waiting for him.
Yeah, no question. And, you know, I think what a lot of people have seen, you know, as the state level funding for education has gone down, people in lots of different municipalities have seen their property taxes go up.
Yep.
And that's something, you know, that no, you know, even if you have a Republican representative in the state legislature, you know, that those people are having to raise property taxes in order to provide the quality of education that their constituents expect. And you know that those Republican legislators don't feel good about that. And so there is an opportunity for us to go to those people and say, hey, we need to get together. We need you to work with the people across the state and come up with a funding bill that's going to adequately provide for education in the state of Pennsylvania, not just because it's a constitutional obligation on the state level, but it's the right thing to do.
Yep.
And there's so much upset about it right now that I think we have an opportunity to make that happen.
Well, I hope you're right, because I look at this and, you know, we're talking about the future of the country. We're talking, honestly, about the people who are going to take care of me when I'm old. And I know that a lot we have to get people to think in their own narrow self-interest. And I go, you know, you think about the doctor who may be treating you down the road, or the nurse that's going to take care of you, or any of the things that, that happen in the future. These are the people that we're investing in right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and that's exactly what's happening throughout the state of Pennsylvania. You know, we want to create good talent here. We want good talent to stay within the state of Pennsylvania. You know, I want Pennsylvania to be the best state to live in the country. And that's not going to happen if we don't have a vibrant system of public education, no matter where you live across the state.
I'm right there with you. Jesse Braxton, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much for the information.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
Jesse Braxton, education organizer at Action United, actionunited.org, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Uh-oh. You always have to worry when you hear that there's, quote, a new air of giddiness on Wall Street. That's a sure sign that financial disaster is looming on our horizon again. After all, giddy is a synonym for feather-brained, frivolous, foolish. This latest outbreak of what was once called irrational exuberance among financial titans has been sparked by a sudden splurge on corporate mergers. In just the past 4 months, a dozen supersized corporate takeovers have siphoned off between $3 billion and $24 billion each in capital. Money dumped into frothy deals that create nothing. Why are they done? Follow the money. First, such financial giants as J.P. Morgan Chase constantly push mergers because bankers pocket a fortune in fees for packaging and financing the buyouts. Second, since CEOs have drastically whacked jobs and wages the past few years while also inflating their stock prices, they've now got trillions of dollars in cash they need to move. How about investing in more employees, better service, or improved products? Nah, it's easier and flashier just to buy up competitors, swell their fiefdoms, and get mega kudos for boldness. Third, the biggest private equity buyout firms are also sitting on mountains of cash they accumulated from speculators before the 2008 crash. Hundreds of billions of these speculator dollars, known as dry powder, have to be invested by the end of this year. So the rush is on for them to snap up corporations, whack as many jobs as possible, sell off or shut down segments of the business, then cash in for themselves and the speculators. This is Jim Hightower saying, one Wall Street economist says, giddily, that today's urge to merge is, quote, a sign that corporate America believes that the economic expansion is going to accelerate. Yeah, and run right over us.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner error, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only shortly after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13, did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that L.C. Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitative use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickschmithshow.com.
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see, I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
Website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. So yesterday, it was, what, 13 hours that the Republicans held the floor, and Senator Rand Paul was being interviewed, first interview after the big filibuster, went on with Glenn Beck, talking about catheters. Evidently, the good senator thought, you know, hey, you know, I thought about it, you know, thought about giving myself a catheter. And you go, really, you do that often, do you? He says that he's put them in before, done it, but he decided against it. Because he said, you know, 12 hours is a long time to not go to the bathroom. Wow. You know, I got to be honest. In some of the things that he said, I was with. You know, and talking about the drones, I don't think we should be using them against American citizens. I mean, there's a lot of civil liberty stuff there that I'm on board with. But that really, I don't think, was about what he was doing there. To me, he was about, hey, you know, national spotlight, little attention. And Glenn Beck said, well, we're going to put you as the president of the United States. No, not going to happen. But he did mention something that caught my ear. He did say something about the Lochner era, which you then go, what are we talking about? Are we talking about going back to the bad old days before? I know. You have the right to do whatever you want. You have the right to contract. And I think of, and it's to me, it's important that this was brought up today, and looking at what happened with these kids that worked at this McDonald's over in Camp Hill. 4320, I think it is. The one over there on Trindle Road. Think of the liberty of contract argument, which is that you should be able to do whatever it is that you and your employer agree to. Given the fact that the relationship from the beginning is unequal, because the employer will have the upper hand, which is why labor laws were passed to kind of level that playing field so that you're at least on similar grounds, not equals, but at least somewhere close to having some voice, to having some say, to having some groundwork. What they want to take us back to is a time where you didn't have any of that say. You came to work and you said, I need to go home after 8 or 12 or 16 or 20 or 25 hours in the case of the one girl at the McDonald's that I talked to. I want to go home. And they said, you can go home. Just keep going. So, you know, how desperate do we want to become as a society? And the right loves to couch this in terms of, well, you have the right to contract. You have the right to do whatever it is you're willing to do. And you go back to some of the things, you know, like in the South, for instance, there were some employers that wouldn't hire women until they were sterilized. So you have a choice, I guess. You can starve or you can do what you're told. And, you know, when you talk about, well, that's a liberty issue. No. Desperation is not part of the Constitution. Sorry. Now, you've got people like Rand Paul. You've got these righties who think the Lochner decision was a wonderful decision. It was fantastic. It was in their view, what brought down Jim Crow. Because it brought down those discriminatory laws. When the reality is most lawyers would tell you, well, it was actually Brown versus Board of Education. And that was on the grounds of equal protection. But think about this whole Rand Paul worldview. And the Tea Parties throw this out. And I think a lot of it is without thinking. What they want you to believe is that the federal government should, and the government in general, state, local government, should be able to do nothing. No Civil Rights Act, no Voting Rights Act, no minimum wage, no maximum hour laws, none of that. No health and safety, none of that. That should all be, if you're willing to work 30 hours a day in toxic environments, and you're going to get cancer, and one out of two people are killed weekly on the job, if you're willing to go into that because your families are desperate enough, then it should be allowed. That's their view. And we're going to hear a lot about Lochner in the coming weeks and months. This is not something that's gone away, and it's something I've been telling you about for years. Because you know, I read the right-wing stuff. They're trying to reinvent this. Trying to make it say, well, you know, this is part of liberty. And if you want to make the argument, and I've had people make the argument to me that exploitation is part of liberty. It should be my liberty to exploit you if I can. And if you don't have adequate power in you, that you should be able to be exploited. I mean, stop and think about this for a while. When you break this down, you end up with a handful of robber barons who control. Oh, wait a minute. You end up with the 1880s. You end up with our history. You end up with corporate titans who have untold amounts of money, and then you have people who toil every day of their lives just to exist. And I know people love to tell me, well, we're so much better than that. Do you know why? We're not that anymore. We're not that anymore because those folks said no more. Those folks said, we're not going to allow this to happen to our kids and to our grandkids. And they organized and they fought. And they fought incrementally for every little gain. You know, originally they were fighting for a 12-hour day, then a 10-hour day, then an 8-hour day. Originally, they were fighting for, you know, safety on the job. So, you know what? Maybe those 6- and 8-year-old kids don't have a 50% fatality rate in the mines. Maybe we take those kids out, give them an education, give them an opportunity. People fought for that. Stuff that we seem to take for granted and more than happy to go, well, we'll give if you can make a profit. We'd better wake up. Because people like Rand Paul are dangerous. And they love to couch themselves in, oh, we love the Constitution, yet the right of exploitation, not in the Constitution. This whole liberty of conscience, not in the Constitution. Sorry, I don't see it. But here's the thing, and you talk to any lawyer who, and I talked to a number of lawyers, and we're going to talk to one here in a couple minutes, who look at the Lochner case as an abomination of what judicial activism shouldn't be doing. Even Robert Bork, if you remember him, back the guy that failed right-wing Supreme Court nominee, even he said it was an abomination. And you don't get much more right-wing than that. So it's going to be interesting to see how they continue to rewrite this. And there are a lot of very well-written right-wingers who have tried to revive this, blow breath back into the Lochner decision. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about it, its history, its origins, and, well, is it coming back? Quick break, right back. Now, who'd have thought?
It was rock and roll.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, Snowball Earth. It's a theory suggesting that more than 650 million years ago, Earth was entirely covered by ice.
There's geologic evidence suggesting this happened, but scientists haven't been able to agree on how an ice-covered Earth could have ever thawed out again, so they've never entirely accepted the snowball Earth theory.
In late 2012, a team of scientists from the U.S., Germany, and France published a paper about how a snowball Earth might have begun to melt. They used a computer model, the same sort of model used to study global warming in our time, to examine the role of clouds above an Earth entirely covered with ice.
In modern studies of climate, clouds play a complex role. They reflect sunlight and so help cool the Earth. And they also trap sunlight and so help warm the Earth. That's why clouds are a challenge in studies of global warming.
But a snowball Earth would have already been highly reflective, so the reflectivity of clouds would be less important, these scientists say. They say clouds' primary role would have been to trap heat and so start melting the ice, thawing the snowball Earth, and leading eventually to the world we know today. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for the words Snowball Earth. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
If the federal government continues to do the kinds of things that this administration is trying to do, backdoor through the National Labor Relations Board, that's killing our free market system.
We're running out of rich people in this country.
The NLRB has become a political sycophant for labor unions.
And one of the things the Congress should do immediately is defund the National Labor Relations Board.
It seems to me that what we're seeing is a ceding of power from Congress to these, to the NLRB and other agencies.
Really is a freedom versus tyranny issue.
I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this would be.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Yeah, it would be a wonderful world if we didn't have any of those laws. And if it was the Wild West, and you know, you think about it, this Lochner case, some of the folks that I've talked to, they've said that this is one of the decisions that has been used to show what the abominations are. You know, along with decisions to uphold segregation, the laws that they went to detain the Japanese into detention camps during World War II. These are the things that they're taught to not do. And yet you've got Rand Paul saying, well, this is a wonderful idea. It's a great decision. Wonderful. It's good for the country. And we should rethink it and go back to those days, which is, well, in my view, dangerous. But don't take my word for it. I've asked Eric Fink, law professor at Elon University, to come talk to us about this. Eric, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, Rick. How you doing?
I am good. You know, I look at this statement by Rand Paul yesterday that the Lochner decision was a wonderful decision and we should revisit it and we should breathe breath back into it and bring it back because we should all have the liberty and the right to be exploited.
Absolutely. It's a strange concept of liberty, isn't it?
And I guess, and I have had this conversation in the past, that having true liberty in some folks' mind is having the liberty to be exploited.
Yeah, what's the old saying about, you know, the rich and poor have the same freedom to sleep under the bridges. It's not surprising to hear somebody like Rand Paul praising this, because the idea behind Lochner is exactly the idea that people should not have any legal protection against being exploited by powerful interests, by corporations, by powerful employers, by powerful entrenched interests. And that's exactly the idea that someone like Rand Paul represents.
You know, I go back and I think of some of the things that I've read over the years and some of the conditions, and I think it's easy for us to forget because we live in the here and now, and there's nobody alive who really has experienced the really nasty stuff of the past, pretty much where the right wants to take us back to, the 1880s, 1890s.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at some point there's got to be a pushback because the billionaire class is funding think tanks and universities and all of these authors to push this kind of stuff because – well, it benefits them.
Well, that's right, and that's what's really important. It's easy to laugh at Rand Paul because he's, you know, to be as polite as I can, kind of a nutcase. But the reality is he's not alone in trying to resuscitate Lochner. This is something that I see from, you know, supposedly respectable law professors and judges and, you know, folks like the Federalist Society, organized reactionary groups that are funded by and support entrenched powerful interests who are making, you know, what appear to be serious arguments that Lochner really is a good idea. So it should be a fringe idea. For 100 years, that was a fringe idea. But there is this real resurgence now. And it's gaining respectability, and it's really important to press back against that and remind people why it was that the Supreme Court did reject that view.
Because it sounds good, doesn't it? I should have the right to contract. I should have the right, the liberty to do what I want to do. I shouldn't have anybody telling me I can't work 90 hours a week. If I want to work 90 hours a week, damn it, I should be allowed.
Why not? I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstraps, and I'm a good independent person. Of course, you know, no sensible person is against hard work. No sensible person is against people having real opportunities to improve themselves. But what they forget is, you know, we are living today after, you know, almost a century of progressive legislation that protected people from this kind of exploitation. And it's easy to take that for granted and think, oh, well, it wouldn't really happen. People wouldn't really be discriminated against. People wouldn't really be oppressed if we just let the market take its course. And we forget that that's not how things really work in the real world.
Well, no, it's just not how it works in this world. I mean, just yesterday we were out at a McDonald's here in the area where another employer, another one of these people are exploiting these J-1 students who are coming here for cultural exchange, for a cultural experience. And what did they find? Not the American dream, but the American nightmare of deplorable living conditions and basically slave labor.
Yeah, the sort of things that most Americans would like to imagine only happens, you know, over there in some other place, but really is increasingly found in, you know, not some hidden warehouse someplace in some neighborhood you don't have to go to, but in good old American corporations like McDonald's, like Walmart, you know, like Starbucks. These companies are increasingly aggressive in trying to get away with squeezing people for as much as they can.
Yeah, and I look at this, and you know, as weak as our labor laws are, there still are some. The people who are pushing this idea to revive Lochner and that it was a wonderful idea, the meager, weak labor laws that we have now, in their opinion, still too onerous, and we should be getting rid of those. And it just blows my mind that any working person in this country would take, would put any serious thought into what they're saying.
Yeah. No, this is the power of ideology, though, Rick. This is, you know, when you have organized people with a lot of money behind them to just push and repeat simplistic ideas, it's very easy to get people to buy into it. And it's surprisingly easy to get people to ignore the reality of their own lives and to buy into some fantasy that's sold to them. It's not that different from, you know, from advertising. Why do people buy McDonald's hamburgers to begin with?
Good point. Horse meat, I guess. Maybe, maybe, who knows? I think Taco Bell had the horse meat thing, right?
But, there you go. I have to admit, I've actually eaten horse meat. I don't think it's that terrible, but I suppose people should tell you if that's what they're selling, if that's what they're selling to you.
Yeah, a little truth in advertising never hurt
yeah,
anyone.
Yeah.
And on this front, I mean, the truth in advertising is we return to these days, we return to those days.
Yeah. No, and we're seeing it in so many places. I mean, we talk about the labor law, we talk about the labor board. Look at what's happening now. You know, Congress is refusing to confirm people. So we have a labor board. We have the president trying to make recess appointments. We have court saying, oh, no, you're not allowed to fill these vacancies. So by simply digging in their heels, you've got folks in Congress who really don't represent a majority of the country able to repeal a law without actually repealing the law.
Yep.
To say, you know, we don't have the votes to get rid of the labor board, but what we're going to do is just act like spoiled children and refuse to let the labor board do what the law says it's supposed to do.
And neuter them, yeah, exactly. So what should the message on this be? I mean, the right has a very simplistic message, and you know, they love to tout that, you know, we need to get rid of government because it'll bring us liberty or, you know, freedom and all of these wonderful conceptual ideas. But, you know, in practice, we know what this brings us. What's the message on this thing?
Yeah, I think it is important for people on our side and people on the worker side, people on the people side to try to, you know, come up with a simple, direct message. And that message has to have something to do with fairness, with justice, with recognizing the dignity of people. That's harder though sometimes to boil down to, you know, a 15-second soundbite.
Or a bumper sticker.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, because the right is masterful at this bumper sticker politic. I mean, they're just fantastic with the two or three word little slogan because I guess tearing something down is a lot easier than, you know, like my grandfather always said, you know, any idiot can tear a house down. It takes you a couple of years to learn how to build one.
Absolutely. And the other thing is, if you don't care about the truth, it's a lot easier to give a simple message. If you care about the truth and you understand that the world is complicated, then it's a lot harder to get that message across in very simple, persuasive terms.
Yeah, and going back to this case in 1905 where evidently the guy worked to somebody beyond the 60-hour law, which I think is a reasonable law. I mean, do we want – I guess the question then becomes, do we want to work 60, 70, 100 hours and being compelled to do so? I know you've got the liberty to leave, but, you know, you've also got the liberty to starve, I guess, too, right?
Yeah, that's and right, that's always the argument. Well, no one's forcing them. They could quit. They could go get another job. Well – What other job? I mean, think about it today. How many unemployed people do we have? Where exactly are they supposed to go? The law in the Lochner case, that's right. It was not exactly a draconian restriction, but it was more than the employers were willing to bear.
And I guess the other question is do I want to be buying bread from somebody working 100 hours?
Well, that's right. You know, I come, as Brett knows, your producer, I come from a long line of bakers. You know, there's a reason for this law. You know, there are serious public health concerns with having people who are overworked and who are, you know, maybe not being careful, maybe not healthy, and producing the food that we eat. But this is the reality today. You know, we supposedly have a 40-hour work week. Nobody really works a 40-hour work week anymore.
Nope.
We've got one group of people who are working 50, 60 hours a week. We've got another group of people who can't get enough work and are lucky if they can get 20 hours a week. And it's just insane.
And now we're seeing with the advent of all of these cell phones and these tablets and all of this electronic media, people are working all the time.
All the time without getting compensated.
And using their own devices to boot.
Yep, they're bearing it. Employers have gotten very, very smart. They're not only able to get you to work for them without being properly paid, they're actually able to get you to pay their business expenses.
Yep.
Labeling people independent contractors, making people work on their own time, work from home, work from their cell phone, and the employers, all they do is collect the profit.
So the question is Lochner already undone?
In some ways, we really are back there. We've still got the laws on the books, but the employers have figured out in many ways that they don't really have to abide by it, that there's not really enforcement, or they can evade it by clever tactics and get away with it.
And what's it going to take for us to push back on this? I mean, at some point, I believe there's only so much of you-know-what people are willing to eat.
Yeah.
And I guess what's that threshold is the question.
That is the big question. The big question is how bad do things have to get. I mean, my belief has always been and remains that the only practical way to do this is for people to organize. Individual workers don't have power. What we've seen, you know, also in recent years is the complete devastation of the labor movement. And until we can turn that around and get people to say, you know, I'm in the same boat as all other workers,
yeah,
I'm going to join with them. Until people remember that lesson, then you're really fighting an uphill battle because the bosses are organized.
No, they
believe in being organized.
Yeah, the money is organized. And you know, it was painfully apparent to me yesterday as I'm standing out on the street with these students who are getting screwed, watching the faces of people go by. And in fact, the one woman in the restaurant looked me dead in the eye and said, when I asked her if she knew what was going on, she said she didn't care.
Yeah. No, because people don't care because they can go to McDonald's, they can get their cheap hamburger, and at some level I can't blame them. You know, you've got people who themselves aren't really making ends meet.
Yeah, but
looking for the cheap, you know, the cheap goods at Walmart, the cheap meal at McDonald's, and how can you blame them?
It's a cycle. Everything comes back. I mean,
exactly.
Don't people understand that by allowing this to happen to these people, it's going to pull us all down? I mean, you might be willing to work 100 hours a week, but you know what? Your neighbor, your coworker might not want to. And by you doing it, you're pulling everybody down. It's this race to the bottom mentality, Eric.
Oh, that's exactly right. And the problem is that people don't see any alternative. They don't see any way out. And so they just decide, I'm just going to do the best that I can for me.
Yeah, and we've got to start talking about how to get away from that and go back and doing the hard work of organizing, as you've pointed out.
One way, Rick, is what you do. You know, getting on the radio and speaking to people in very plain terms, you know, not necessarily professors like me who talk in fancy words, but having people just say very directly, you know, this is, you're being lied to and you need to wake up.
Yep. Well, I'm glad you came on and talked to us about this because this is one of those issues that we don't hear an awful lot about. But when we do, we always hear it from the wrong people.
Well, I'm glad that this is an issue that you press on because I think it's tremendously important.
I'm right there with you. Eric Fink, I appreciate the time. Look forward to talking to you again.
Always a pleasure, Rick. Take care.
Thanks, Eric. Eric's a law professor at Elon University. Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. And talking about these smartphones, you look at all the number of the people who have got them. The numbers have gone through the roof. The number of working people who now have these devices in their pockets, in their hands, the notepads, all of this stuff. In fact, the number of full-time workers who now own smartphones is up to nearly two-thirds of full-time workers, up from just 48% 2 years ago. And eventually, you're going to get to the point to where just to have a job, you're going to have one of these. And you're going to probably clock in and do all of your work. And you know, we talked about the people who clean hotels, like the Hyatt workers, who they give these devices to say, well, you know, we want to bark at you all the time. Bark out orders, know where you are, follow you. And you think about that for a second. GPS, tracking, they know everything you're doing. And I go back to 1984, the book where they talk about the TV being everywhere and, you know, this big monstrosity is watching you in the room. And, you know, is amazing as that book is, as you understand, it was written in 1939. Before any of that stuff was really mainstream or even really all that much thought about, think about how much they were right on. And then think about how bad it's now going to be where you're voluntarily carrying around your tracking device. And the employer, especially if they give it to you, has the right to that. So I guess, you know, the conversation I had with Eric Fink is right. You know, has Lochner already been broken based on the fact that the 8-hour day is gone? This idea of you go in, do your 8 hours, the eat and skate mentality is done. Because, you know, how many times have you gotten emails at 11 o'clock at night, the boss saying, well, I want to have this by 5 a.m. I know you're not supposed to come in until 9, but I want it by 5 a.m. And again, I go back to, you know, how much of you know what are we willing to eat? And then you have this culture that we've been force fed that it's this competitive culture. Well, we've got to all be competitive. We're competing against our coworker and what competition really is. And this is what I love. I love the right wing frame of this. We need more competition because competition, you know, does all of these wonderful things in their view. Especially when we can put pit workers against one another and they can compete each other down to paltry wages, no benefits, and horrible working conditions. Yet if you look at the very top, you look at the big companies, they don't want competition. They don't want to compete with each other. They generally collude with each other. You look at gas stations. They're all within a penny or so of each other. They don't want to fight with each other. You break out into a war, profits go down. When we can get workers to compete against each other, profits go up. When companies compete against each other, profits go down. What do you think the wealth class of this country wants? Do you think they want you competing or them? I mean, we've really got to be thinking about these things in much different terms. And I can't tell you how many people, especially in the South, have told me, well, what we need to do is more competition. And I go, well, show me that where that's benefited society. Because what it generally does is it ends up taking wealth out of the hands of you and me. And a lot of that decoupling of wages to productivity happened because we were pursuing the neoliberal agenda. You know, the late 70s is when all this stuff really started happening. In the mid to late 70s, neoliberalism took hold. This idea that, hey, we can manufacture things everywhere else. When the auto industry first went to Brazil, when they first left the country, that was the shot, man. And the rest of manufacturing eventually went with it. And I read an article today over at The Patriot, one of those opinion pieces by some right-wing crank who said, you know, this recession that Obama inherited, and he said it was a bad one, but it has been like any other in that we haven't bounced back as quickly. You know, back in the days, you know, in the old days when we had a recession, we'd bounce back. And the reason we would bounce back is because the jobs always came back. The factories would lay people off, but the factories remained. So when people started producing or consuming again, production would ramp up. They would call the workers back. So you would have, you know, the contracts in place to make sure the wages were fairly elastic. So you'd go back to work, making a decent wage, and everything would start over again. Now what we've done is we've shipped those jobs overseas. Those factories are closed. There's nothing to go back to. So those millions of jobs that we lost from the beginning of the Bush recession until Obama saved us from absolute disaster with a very minimal stimulus bill, we lost millions of jobs that are not coming back. A lot of them are in manufacturing. And you know, the folks at the Alliance for American Manufacturing say, look, over the last decade, we've lost 55,000 manufacturing facilities with over 500 people in it. You think of all those jobs, kaput, gone. Those were the jobs that brought the people out of recession. Those are the jobs people got called back to. And now what do we have? Well, we're living the Reagan dream. We're a service-based economy. And as manufacturing comes back, and it is trickling back through incentive, and I love how the Republicans, well, we don't want to invest in any of that stuff. It's coming back, but at what cost and at what wage? Makes you think. Going to take a quick break. Right back with hour three of the program. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
On July 5, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, it should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry. Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, termination, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The recent tragic and brutal murder of Federal Corrections Officer Eric Williams at the U.S. Penitentiary in Canaan, Pennsylvania, is the direct result of dangerous understaffing in the federal prison system. That's according to the Council of Prison Locals Union, an affiliate of the American Federation of Government Employees. Dale Desautels is president of the Council of Prison Locals. He says given the already dangerous understaffing, the sequestration cuts will have a literal life and death impact on thousands of corrections officers.
Now if you go to sequestration, where we remove another 10 to 20% of the staff from each shift or from that institution at any particular time between now and October 1st, schedules will be changed, people's lives will be changed, and they'll be put more in danger because there'll be less people to respond.
Desautels says federal workers have already been hit with $103 billion in concessions, including pay freezes for 2 years and cuts in pensions. His Council of Prison Locals and AFGE wants Congress to recognize the dangers of prison understaffing and to do something to correct the problem, because understaffing and overcrowding in federal prisons is a prescription for disaster.
Whatever Congress does, whether they do taxes or close loopholes, we don't even have a budget. So at least give us a budget to where we can function at the same levels of last year or what have you. To try to enforce the sequester this year perhaps was too big of a bite for the entire government to try to consume in 1 year.
Now with more labor news, here's Jesse Russell.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Texas is a right-to-work state. Texas is a great state. We could be the Texas of the Northeast.
Cause in the real world, they're shutting Detroit down. While the boss man takes his bonus pay and gyps on out of town.
We could be the Texas of the Northeast when it comes to drilling, yes. And, you know, we could be the... Well, we could be the Chicago of the Northeast as well. When you look at what we're doing, what they're doing to education, we're on the same path. And I look at what the Chicago Public Schools communication director had to say, a woman named Becky Carroll. She told the Chicago Tribune that big classes don't necessarily hamper learning. No, it doesn't do that at all. She said it's the quality of the teaching in that classroom. You could have a teacher, she said, that is high quality, that could take 40 kids in a class and help them succeed. And I go, you know, here's the thing. I've been in a class where they've had 40 kids in it, and they're usually packed in so tight that they can't even trip over each other, let alone learn. And I asked the question, are we going to end up like the Detroit public schools, where the one kindergarten class last year was cited for a fire violation for having 52 kids in a classroom? Is that where we're taking education? And sadly, I can't argue that we're not. I look at this governor we've got, and I look at governors across the country, both Republicans and Democrats, which is why we need to be standing up, fighting back, just like they're doing in Chicago and in Philadelphia. I've got Wendy Caton. She's with the group Raise Your Hand, a parent of a Chicago students. They're fighting these closures. Philly was talking about closing 29 schools. Chicago's talking about closing 80 of them. Wendy, thanks for taking time for me.
No problem. Happy to be here.
So I look at this, and I see Philadelphia talking about closing 29 schools. 80 schools they're talking about closing in Chicago? Are you kidding me?
Well, it's actually still 129 this independent commission did say that the district has the capacity to close 80, which is absurd, but that's not a prescriptive number yet, so we're still waiting to see what the district comes out with on March 31st. So, all of these numbers are insane. They're absurd. It's based on a totally flawed formula on space utilization that is just completely inaccurate.
So what's pushing all this? Is it that just that we don't have enough students, or is it this whole push towards privatization?
Well, I think it's a push to close neighborhood schools. And, I mean, our district wants to open more charters. They're opening charters at every board meeting as they're giving PowerPoints on underutilization. So they're saying, you know, we have to right-size the district, but they're really only talking about half the issue. They're opening new schools. This year, I think they've approved 14 already. So, I mean, it's a change to move away from neighborhood public schools as we know it. And, again, it's based on a completely flawed formula. We deconstructed their formula and found that they are tacking on 20% to how they utilize classrooms above 30 kids in a class. So you can have 36 kids in a classroom in Chicago and be considered efficient. So they have this crazy formula that they basically use to create a false narrative about our district, and they're just opening, you know, new charter schools at the same time, some that don't even have a location planned for them. So it's absurd.
Well, they've got a location. It's one of those 129 schools that they're talking about closing.
Maybe. We don't know. I mean,
because for me, it just looks like it's this shift away from public control of the citizens in that community into the hands of people who are unaccountable to those folks. And now I understand charter schools are publicly funded, and that's about as close to public schools as they wanted to get. They want the public money, just not the oversight or the responsibility to have to educate all of the children.
Exactly. Our charter schools, we've looked at the numbers, and, you know, they're educating a much lower percentage of children in special education. We're really worried because there are 6,000 kids on this current list of 129 schools that are in special education classes. 39 of the schools that they have on the list are special ed cluster programs where, you know, our most vulnerable kids, where they're busing them in to get special services, and they're going to kick these kids out and put them who knows where. We've got 2,508 homeless students on this list. I mean, it's horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, the problems are much bigger than evaluating teachers or coming up with the next gimmick. And I keep saying, if we're going to really, truly give every child in this country an opportunity, there are some problems that are much bigger than what's going on in the classroom. And as you've pointed out, you've got thousands of kids who are homeless.
Right. And they're going to displace them yet again. They're going to put kids in, you know, with autism. There's many kids on this list, to some new environment. I mean, and who knows where. There's no guarantee that any of these kids will be going anywhere in or near their neighborhood. And, you know, I've done walkthroughs at many of these schools that are on the list, and they're truly not underutilized. They didn't even take things like special education into account when they did their calculations on utilization. So it's really devastating. It's going to be really, really harmful.
So in your opinion, is this ideological or just bean counters who have a formula that it's just how it works out, and it's just how it is? Because I tend to believe it's ideological.
I think that, I mean, if you look at the way neighborhood schools have shifted over the years, we've done some number crunching, and we are moving away from educating kids in neighborhood schools. So I do think it's a push towards, you know, charters and, you know, restricted access kind of schools, and really, destruction of neighborhood schools. So I do think, you know, market-driven reform, and I think it's about destroying neighborhood schools.
Yeah, we're gonna bust those units into the education factory,
right?
And gonna stamp out little smart people who can push buttons and know what to do when they're told.
Exactly.
And I got to be honest, that scares me.
Yeah, it scares a lot of us. There are a lot of terrified parents in Chicago right now.
So I look at you as a parent, and as I guess you're the director of Raise Your Hand.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you think that, you know, when you took your child to kindergarten, that here a couple years later you were going to be leading an organization to make sure that they get the education that you thought that they were entitled to?
I did not. I had no plans. It was totally grassroots. It was just from witnessing kind of the insanity of budget cuts, yearly budget cuts, and just taking away of more and more, you know, of our programs, the little that we had. And, you know, our group just formed out of necessity and completely unplanned.
And that's generally how this stuff happens, because, you know, and the reason I think it's important for our listeners to hear folks like you, Wendy, is because this isn't your job. This isn't what you wanted to do. This is what you were pushed into doing. This is what you were called to do.
Exactly. It was not planned at all, but it's so important. And we've had, you know, some success. We've rallied thousands of parents. We go to Springfield, you know. I mean, we're in a crisis right now, and it's very scary, but, you know, I think that there's also a lot of good organizing going on right now in Chicago, and I would say more and more parents from across the whole city are working together and are, you know, becoming united on these issues, because it's so critical right now here in Chicago and as we see in other places around the country. So we have to keep working together because it's not going to get any better.
No, it's
not.
And it's not. And
we can advocate.
And politically, the answer is not one party or the other, because they both seem to be sold down this privatization path.
Absolutely. It's not. I mean, it's very disappointing.
Because, you know, here in Philadelphia, they said, I heard that they were closing a school in the Germantown School District, but not Germantown Academy, where to go to high school there, it's $30,000 a year. You don't see them putting 30 or 40 kids in a class. And I know your mayor there in Chicago, I know his kid doesn't have 40 kids in a class.
No, his kid's in private school. And even within, you know, certain areas of the city, you see additions happening in his ward in schools that aren't even deemed underutilized. So we have a lot of disparity right now. And it's hard to believe. I mean, I almost feel like I'm in a Kafka novel. It's so surreal what's happening.
And the sad thing is it's the moneyed interest, a handful of moneyed interest who are really pushing this entire agenda, not just in Chicago or Philadelphia, but in places like Cleveland and Milwaukee and Detroit and all of the urban cities across this country. There is this national push to do exactly what they're doing in Chicago and Philly everywhere. And eventually, like I tell people in my neighborhood, once they're done there, they're coming here.
Exactly. I think they're actually using the Broad Handbook on school closings, if you've seen that. I mean, they're
the
literally
book,
taking
sure.
language out of it here and I think in Philadelphia and just, you know, page for page, just taking, you know, excerpts out and using that to guide the closings of schools.
Which is why we need to be activated, educated, engaged. We need to be talking to our friends, our neighbors, our family. We need to get out in the streets, and we need to do what folks like you, Wendy, are doing, starting groups, starting organizations, and pushing back.
I agree.
And I give you nothing but the utmost credit, and I wish you the best. And as things continue, I'd love to have you back.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much, Wendy. Wendy Kenton, director of Raise Your Hand. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
And take your money. All they want to do is. And take your money.
Listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Uh-oh. You always have to worry when you hear that there's, quote, a new air of giddiness on Wall Street. That's a sure sign that financial disaster is looming on our horizon again. After all, giddy is a synonym for feather-brained, frivolous, foolish. This latest outbreak of what was once called irrational exuberance among financial titans has been sparked by a sudden splurge on corporate mergers. In just the past 4 months, a dozen supersized corporate takeovers have siphoned off between $3 billion and $24 billion each in capital. Money dumped into frothy deals that create nothing. Why are they done? Follow the money. First, such financial giants as J.P. Morgan Chase constantly push mergers because bankers pocket a fortune in fees for packaging and financing the buyouts. Second, since CEOs have drastically whacked jobs and wages the past few years while also inflating their stock prices, they've now got trillions of dollars in cash they need to move. How about investing in more employees, better service, or improved products? Nah, it's easier and flashier just to buy up competitors, swell their fiefdoms, and get mega kudos for boldness. Third, the biggest private equity buyout firms are also sitting on mountains of cash they accumulated from speculators before the 2008 crash. Hundreds of billions of these speculator dollars, known as dry powder, have to be invested by the end of this year. So the rush is on for them to snap up corporations, whack as many jobs as possible, sell off or shut down segments of the business, then cash in for themselves and the speculators. This is Jim Hightower saying, one Wall Street economist says, giddily, that today's urge to merge is, quote, a sign that corporate America believes that the economic expansion is going to accelerate. Yeah, and run right over us.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. There was an ABC News poll that came out that claimed that that Americans, well, they supported, by large numbers, the sequester. But when you look at the numbers, what they say is the poll are 61 to 33, they support a 5% cut. Which is even more than it is actually. But support for a 5% reduction in federal spending crosses party lines in the poll, according to ABC. They did this with Langer Research Associates. It includes 57% of Democrats, 6 and 10 independents, and 3/4 of Republicans. But you go through and you look at what Pew found, and the cuts that people are in favor of, not so much what the right would have you believe, and definitely not across the board. In fact, if you look at some things like veterans benefits and education, the majority of people say we should be increasing spending on that. 60% of the people in the poll said we should be increasing spending on education. People say we should be increasing the amount of money we spend on roads and bridges. And the amount of people who say we should be decreasing spending, very small. You start looking at the one that the right has pushed heavily. We need to stop feeding the world's needy. In fact, 48% of the people in the Pew poll said we should decrease the money going to that. But if you add it up, the people who want to keep it the same or increase it, it's still more than the ones who want to decrease it. So this argument that, well, the majority of the people want it, no, it's not how it is. Especially when you're talking about education, when you're talking about veterans benefits, when you're talking about Social Security, when you're talking about taking care of people during a natural disaster, when you're talking about doing the things that government does, like food and drug inspections, like all the anti-terrorism stuff, like all the money that we're spending on scientific research, very, very little. A very small number of the people want that stuff cut. Because I think people get that the money that we invest comes back. So the message has been, well, you know, people want the cuts because it's easy to say. And, you know, I did a TV interview not too long ago where the woman that I was there with, the right one woman, she kept saying, well, you're at the kitchen table, at the kitchen table, at the kitchen table. You know, I cut 2%. Like somehow it's the same thing. And it's not. Not even close. When you're talking about cutting 2% of the budget for, let's say, the federal corrections system, that money doesn't come out of profits. Money comes out of staffing. And as you heard in the clip, you know, at the top of the hour, you know, last week there was a guy who, because of staffing cuts, was murdered on the job. Do we want more of that? I don't think so. You know, we see all of these stories of all of these cuts and all of this pain across the board, all of the job losses. You know, this austerity that the right's been ramming down our throat. The one number I saw, the most common number I see, is we've lost 700,000 jobs in the public sector because of austerity and because of sequestration. We could lose another 700,000 jobs. And I look at this, and it makes me wonder, you know, who's running things. And I listen to the same people, and this is what's got me just kind of shaking my head. The same people who voted for Bush, all of his wars, all of his handouts to the very wealthy, all of the nation building. Where were they during all of those years when the Bush people ran up massive amounts of debt? And I always think back to, I remember when Bush took office, and maybe it's just that I have a memory. And maybe you'll remember it too. We were actually talking about in a decade being debt free. By this point, had George W. Bush not pursued the policies that he pursued, we could have been debt free. You think about all the money he gave away during the handout. You think about the wars, you think about all of the waste and in how they operated things, and don't forget the prescription drug bill that says, you know, hey, we can't negotiate for prices. We don't do that. We're Americans, damn it. We pay full price. And I look at that report that I talked about yesterday from the Special Inspector General for the Iraq Reconstruction, a guy named Stuart Bowen. And he goes through and says, look, you know, we've spent more than $60 billion building the things that we blew up. That's not the cost of the war. That's just the cost of rebuilding the stuff that we blew up. It's $90 billion in Afghanistan. What we've spent in Iraq, what we had spent there, was almost $800 billion. And you go, could we have used that money differently? Could we have used that not to run up? Because understand, that $800 billion, that was on the giant credit card. But I didn't hear the radical right screaming about that. And I certainly didn't hear them screaming when contractors were charging $1,000 for a $7 switch or $80 for a pipe that cost $1. You know, I'll never forget the story of Halliburton, who was supplying the food. And this is one of those things that back during when all this was going on, I was screaming about. How can your military last on a supply chain that's privatized, that brings you rancid food and contaminated water, and then charges you $30 a meal to do it? A sheet of plywood, $100. Are you kidding me? And you look at the misadventures in some of the construction that we had done. They built a 3,600-bed prison back in 2004, spent $40 million on it, and then abandoned it. How many people remember the police academy with the raw sewage dripping from the ceiling and through the light sockets? And you know, you look at this and you go, where were you people then? Where were the fiscal conservatives? Nowhere to be found. Look, I'm as fiscally conservative as anyone. Probably more so. Because I believe you pay your bills. I believe you don't run up bills if you don't have to. But I also believe in if my roof had a hole in it, you fix it. You spend the investment to fix it because it only gets worse, right? I believe in when you're driving the car down the road and change the oil occasionally, right? About every 3,000 miles. Why? You want to take care of it. You want to invest in your investment. I see that no different than funding education. I see that in no different light than funding seniors programs. I see that in no different light than helping the needy and helping those who need a helping hand up. I don't see any difference. And maybe that's part of my problem, that I see my children and the education that they're getting is an investment in the future of our nation, and that if we can get them the best possible education, they're going to get that leg up in the global economy. Because understand, we've been pitted against everybody else. And while I don't see a modern-day Bretton Woods coming back anytime soon, we're going to be pitted against each other for a fairly long time. So we had better figure out how we're going to compete and to do it in a way to where we're not competing on who's going to slit each other's throats for pennies, because that's where we're going, folks. You know, there was a time when competition was about who provided the best service, not who did it the cheapest. Because I don't want a workforce based on who's willing to work in exploitable conditions, who's willing to work for the cheapest wage, who's willing to work without health care, who's willing to work without a pension, who's willing to work and not see their families. We've done that. We've seen that movie. Don't want to go back to it. You know, which is why I thought it was interesting that you see Nancy Pelosi out talking about raising the minimum wage. Oh, kind of late on this one. We should have been talking about raising the minimum wage back in 2009. Because getting money into people's pockets, that's how you turn your economy around. And there are some business leaders who get it. And I know I'm going to probably take a raft of you know what. But, you know, the CEO of Costco, the CEO and president, a guy named Craig Jelinek, he now supports the, I don't know if he ever didn't, but he's out in support of the Fair Minimum Wage Act of 2013 that would raise the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour and then adjust it, index it to inflation. So as inflation goes up, it goes up so that you don't have another span of 5 or 10 years where the minimum wage is eaten away and eroded by inflation. But what Jelinek said, he said, you know, at Costco, where he's the CEO and president of, he said, we know that paying employees good wages makes good sense for business. We pay a starting hourly wage of $11.50 an hour in all states we do business. And we're still able to keep our overhead costs low. He said, an important reason for the success of Costco's business model is the attraction and retention of quality employees. He said, instead of minimizing wages, we know it's a lot more profitable in the long term to minimize employee turnover and maximize employee productivity, commitment, and loyalty. He said, we support efforts to increase the federal minimum wage. To me, that's the direction we should be going, based on good work, based on loyalty, based on service, based on quality, not based on, I'm going to slit your throat for a penny. And I guess there are two ways you can look at the business environment, the Walmart way or this way. And when we get a chance, we go to Costco. I wish there was one closer to where I live. Because these are the kind of people we need to be supporting. Keep these folks in business. So Pelosi comes out and says, well, you know, and after these huge stock market gains of which, you know, what is it, 3 days in a row we've peaked records, she says it's time. It's time to raise that federal minimum wage up to $10.10 an hour. And what you've got is you've got the ALEC folks, the American Legislative Exchange people, who have been out there, you know, pushing the gun laws and the voter suppression laws and all that stuff. Evidently, legislators across the country, who are ALEC members have introduced 67 laws in 25 states across the country to weaken the minimum wage, to weaken labor law. And of the 67, 11 of them have become law. And you look at the one in Arizona that weakens public sector wage contracts. You've got a number of this, and they're really going after, I think it was New Hampshire, wants to repeal the state's minimum wage. Nah, you understand, you're still going to have the federal minimum wage, which, you know, they'll probably then say, well, we should secede over that because we should have states' rights. If we don't want to pay people, then we shouldn't have to. But here we are, stock market, all-time high. It's it, man. It's 14,000, some, the highest it's been in since the Depression. Things are great on Wall Street. Not so much for you and me, though. And what I keep hearing is the right screaming, oh, we'll have to lay people off. And I say, well, show me where that's happened. It hasn't. Chicken Little, the sky is falling. A quick break. When we come back, and talk with Ellen Ratner from Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back after this.
For the homeless, for the poor, who cares about the deficit? We won a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And another one of those shows of tit for tat. I'll get you. I'm going to stick my thumb in your eye. Louie Gohmert, the Republican from Texas, has filed an amendment on the continuing resolution bill, saying that, well, until President Obama restores the tours of the White House, no golf. And you go, you know, are you kidding me? And the idea is that if the president can't go anywhere without spending money, because you got to have the Secret Service that follows him around, that's mandated by law. So basically they're going to, the idea, I guess, of this is we're going to sequester the president in his room. And it's kind of interesting, kind of funny, but again, very, very, very petulant. Just my thought. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world. I've got Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Alan, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you so much.
So locking the president in his room, it's the way it looks.
Well, you know, I guess I have a little bit of a differing opinion on that. And I think the president actually got rotten advice when he canceled the White House tours. Because they canceled the White House tours on the sequestration thing. But I actually did the math and talked to certain people and this, that, and the other. And it really wouldn't have cost that much money, maybe $500,000, maybe $600,000, to continue the White House tours. And you have families who have saved up for a very long period of time to get their eighth-grade kid to Washington, or even for that one family vacation to see Washington. And that's the last thing that should have gone. Honestly, I don't mind locking up the president if they would have continued the White House tours.
All right. Well, good. I mean, it's just to me, it's just the canceling of those just seems dumb to me. This whole thing just seems stupid to me.
Well, the whole thing is stupid. And then they also canceled West Wing tours. And these are usually family members of staff members who are coming through on a weekend, or sometimes husbands and wives of a press person or a kid, you know, take your child to work day, all that kind of thing. And they cancel that, and that isn't costing them any extra money.
No.
I just think it's honestly they don't want to be bothered. I'm really pretty upset about it. And I voted for Obama. I'd vote for him again, but I got to tell you, I think this is tin ear of politics.
Yeah, I mean, on both sides of it. That's the reason I brought it up. I mean, it's both sides of this. Well, if you did this, I'll do this. And it just seems to be, you know, I've got an 11-year-old and a 7-year-old that they do this all the time with the 4-year-old. I see this all the time. My kids do this kind of stuff to each other. And you expect that from kids because that's what kids do.
Right. That's why they have parents.
Exactly. You know, but you don't expect it from the people running the most powerful country on earth. But I guess maybe that's just too much to ask for. Anyway, I don't know if you know, but your good friend Randy Weingarten was arrested this afternoon in Philadelphia.
I did not know that.
Yeah, she was arrested, and good for her. You know, trying to hold up this SRC meeting, the school reform committee meeting that was going to close their goal to close schools across Philadelphia. Good for her and the 18 others who were arrested.
How did they arrest them?
Well, they were blocking the entrance to the meeting room, trying to hold, because the whole idea of this meeting was to shut down schools.
No.
Yeah. And good for her.
So they were having this meeting to shut down the school. The union went and said, you can't shut down the school.
Well, they went and they said, look, you know, the people of the community have a plan to save these schools and to save public education. What's going on in Philadelphia is this whole push towards these charters and this privatization, and it is happening big time. And, you know, the community, I mean, we've talked to numerous people through community groups, the teachers union. I said, you know, you've got to put a moratorium on this. Stop this. There's a study or a report, a how-to manual, if you will, just put out on how you close these schools down, the timing and all of the stuff that goes around it. And it's all the profiteers.
Good for Randy. I'll have to send her an email.
And that's what I said. Good for her. And thank goodness there's somebody paying attention and somebody willing to stand up for these kids.
Amazing.
So let's get to the news. I know one of your colleagues, Bob Ney, just came out with a book, and Speaker Boehner had a little.
He'll be on with you, I think, on Wednesday and talking about the book.
I'm anxious to find out about it. What did Boehner have to say about it?
Well, Boehner was asked in his press conference, you know, what do you think about Bob Ney's accusations that you were drinking, that you were with a woman, that you made him a deal? And all he would say is, this is a disgraced former congressman who was convicted and went to jail, and he's just trying to sell books.
Yeah, is it true, though?
Well, nobody followed up to say, well, okay, did you promise him a deal? Did you make deals? How about your drinking? Were you with this woman? No. Nobody followed it through.
Or didn't get the chance to. Because, look, I mean, at the end of the day, didn't his family own a bar? I mean, I can see Boehner throwing back a bunch.
Well, and he's famous in Washington for drinking. Everybody knows about that. And Bob Day's point of view is this man is third in line to be president of the United States of America.
Yep.
And when you're third in line to be president of the United States of America, the American people ought to know what you're doing.
I'm right there with you. Yeah, especially if you're one of those people out there pointing fingers.
Exactly.
That's always been the thing for me. It's always been the hypocrisy. You know, you don't point your finger at me, and I won't have any problem with you. You get caught doing something, as long as you weren't the one, you know, saying I'm holier than thou, and then you're out running around. I got a problem with that. But if you're one of those people who said none of my business, and you get caught, that's none of my business. It's just how
right.
It's how I view things. It's the hypocrisy that bothers me.
Oh, and there's a lot of that in Washington, and I think that's what Bob Ney's book is all about. And I can't wait till you get a copy of it and you can take a look.
I'm anxious to get a hold of it and read it and have him talk about it. So some news about Hugo Chavez. His last words: I don't want to die. I guess pretty much the.
I guess not. And the people around, and then he died of pneumonia, which was obviously related to the cancer.
Right.
I mean, did you look at those pictures of him? I mean, he's so bloated from all the steroids and everything.
Yeah, do you think he's, I guess they're going to put him on public display or something like this?
Oh, I mean, they said no drinking. I mean, who knows?
So is the country going to go?
And he's mad at the imperial, you know, they're all mad at the imperialist United States.
Yeah. North Korea as well. I guess they've threatened a preemptive strike.
Well, they have threatened, and the United Nations, everybody, including China and Russia, did not veto increased sanctions on them. And therefore, they cannot bring in, obviously, anything to make missiles or materials that would go in them, but also luxury items, boats, diamonds, rubies, fancy cars, all that kind of stuff. Are prohibited now because that's what the upper class wants.
Yeah, but you know, and I guess maybe there'll be some anger there, but as I understand it, the vast majority of the country lives in abject poverty.
And starving. We ought to cut it off.
I'm right there with you, but the sad reality is our best intelligence came from Dennis Rodman.
That's sad.
I mean, there's something seriously wrong with that.
Say the least.
Now, do they have the capacity? I've read a couple of stories that, you know, have said that, you know, the North Koreans don't have the capacity to hit the U.S. with a nuclear weapon, but some are saying that they're very close, and I saw a couple that said, you know, who knows?
Well, we used to say that we really did know what was going on in North Korea a lot because of our U-2 spy planes and our various satellites. I'm not sure we do know now because so much of this takes place in buildings.
Yeah.
So far, even our satellites can't see in buildings. They may be able to read a license plate from 50,000 feet, but they can't see buildings.
Yeah, good point. What did you think yesterday of Rand Paul's his rant? I got to be honest. I was in favor of, you know, the conversation of how are we using these drones. I'm with him on that. He went into some really crazy other areas, though, wanting to take us back to the days of Lochner and all kinds of insanity along that. I'm curious what the buzz in D.C. is and what your thoughts are.
The buzz in D.C. is everybody wants to see more real filibusters instead of holds because a lot of people were watching the argument. And found it actually pretty interesting. Parts of it they liked, parts of it they thought were crazy. But the press today at the White House press corps was very impressed with how, in fact, that they had a real filibuster and they want more of it.
I said that from the beginning. It's entertaining. It's cheap entertainment. And, you know, you actually get to see who these people are. And I guess Senator Paul considered a catheter, I guess. He was, because evidently he's done it before.
Well, I guess he did consider it. Can you imagine having to get up? He said he should have eaten a bigger breakfast.
Well, you know, hey, that's the job. That's what you signed up for.
Yeah, and you get paid a lot of money to do that job.
Yeah. But I see that the Republicans are kind of split over this. I saw McCain and Lindsey Graham went after him.
McCain and Lindsey Graham are saying basically in their own little way, grow up. That isn't what they said, but they said let me find their exact words. I have them right written down here. McCain actually, although they're a duo, they said, calm down, Senator. U.S. government cannot randomly target U.S. citizens. Well, the issue isn't randomly targeting them. It's targeting them, not randomly.
Good point. But here I saw the right go just nuts, and, you know, a couple of people say, well, you know, they're going to use drones against the Tea Party, and I'm going, well, what Tea Party? This, all it is a paper tiger at this point with a lot of money.
Right.
So I saw
exactly.
that. I saw that Jay Carney read Holder's letter to the press corps.
He read Holder's letter, which is about three sentences long, and what happened is Senator Leahy, who's head of the Judiciary Committee, voted against. Along with the other Vermont Senator Sanders and Jeff Merkley of Oregon, voted against the nomination of the CIA Director Brennan, and basically said in his letter, he said, the administration has stonewalled, very strong word for a senator used, particularly of the same party,
right,
has stonewalled me and the Judiciary Committee for too long on a reasonable request to review the legal justification for the use of drones in targeted killings of U.S. citizens. That's pretty strong language.
That is pretty strong. In your opinion, as someone who's been, you know, in D.C. all these years, is this going to be an issue? I mean, is this not going to go away? Because, you know, I understand there's a lot of information that's not been put out, and as you've said, the senators there say there's some stonewalling. Is this going to be an issue?
Hopefully it won't go away too quickly, and hopefully they'll really put heat on the White House to do it.
Because, you know, as I look at this, I want there to be transparency. I want there to be some oversight because, look, and I just where I agree with Rand Paul. You don't know if the next guy's going to be crazy.
No, you don't. And you don't know who's going to withhold information. And that's exactly why Congress and particularly the Senate Judiciary Committee has a reasonable right to that.
Right.
And as Dianne Feinstein said, we ought to have this conversation with the American people.
Absolutely. But at the end of it, I don't want it all out on the front pages. That's where I'm a little, I think there are some national security things that don't need to be splashed on the front page of the newspaper, but there
right.
should be people paying attention to it and have the information to keep an eye on. But you know, I don't know. I'm just hung up on this, I think. The Brennan nomination went through, though. He's been confirmed.
The Brennan nomination went through, not even a question, although, as I said, three Democrats voted with the Republican.
Yep. Well, we'll see how this all turns out. Ellen, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate
that. Thank you. Have a great evening.
You too. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. People, come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Earth, sky.
Today, Snowball Earth. It's a theory suggesting that more than 650 million years ago, Earth was entirely covered by ice.
There's geologic evidence suggesting this happened, but scientists haven't been able to agree on how an ice-covered Earth could have ever thawed out again. So they've never entirely accepted the Snowball Earth theory.
In late 2012, a team of scientists from the U.S., Germany, and France published a paper about how a snowball Earth might have begun to melt. They used a computer model, the same sort of model used to study global warming in our time, to examine the role of clouds above an Earth entirely covered with ice.
In modern studies of climate, clouds play a complex role. They reflect sunlight and so help cool the Earth. And they also trap sunlight and so help warm the Earth. That's why clouds are a challenge in studies of global warming.
But a snowball Earth would have already been highly reflective, so the reflectivity of clouds would be less important, these scientists say. They say clouds' primary role would have been to trap heat, and so start melting the ice, thawing the snowball Earth, and leading eventually to the world we know today. For more, come to EarthSky.org and search for the words Snowball Earth. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
And I think it's going to be awakening to us because just like the schools, when we cut the funding for schools, now we've put it back in the budget, so they really didn't get cut. But I think now schools are starting to step up to the plate and look how they can maybe partner with private people to bring education, like, better into the schools.
Inequality I just ignored. Don't know what a golden rule is for. But I do know a thing or two. And if all the states were red, no blue, what a wonderful world this would be.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. Also, go to our Facebook page. Just get there from the website. Easy, easy little job. Just a click away. This didn't take long. Not at all. Didn't take long at all. The NRA said we should put armed policemen in every classroom. We want armed guards everywhere. We're going to keep our kids safe. The best way to keep our kids safe, more guns, right? Except in Philadelphia, where the school district is, the contract proposal is teachers can't use reasonable force to defend themselves. So, you know, it kind of blows the mind. We're going to give them a gun and then not be able to defend themselves. You figure it out. I can't. But, you know, they said that's how we're going to keep the kids safe. We're going to keep them safe. Gun in every classroom. Well, didn't take long. There is a school district up in New York, the Highland High School, the Highland Central School District, where an officer was walking down the hall, and his .45 caliber pistol, at about 1:38 p.m. on Tuesday, accidentally discharged in the hallway. Just happened. It was just an accident. It just went boom. I don't know what happened. It just happened. Now, guns in every classroom, safer. Safer. All things would be wonderful. What if he would have killed somebody? Just a question. And you look at this latest study that's out that says, and you know, it's kind of common sense, that states with more gun laws have fewer gun deaths. Seems to reason. The fewer guns, the fewer gun-related deaths. And I know the right loves to say, you know, Rick, more people are killed with hammers than with guns. Well, not here in Harrisburg. It's 3-1 right now. Guns are beating hammers 3-1. The report published online yesterday in the Journal of American Medicine, the Internal Medicine, they looked at the areas with the lower gun deaths, lower suicides, lower homicides, you know, all of that stuff, you know, lower. Places that had lax gun laws, the other is true, higher. The four-year study, there were nearly 122,000 gun-related deaths. 122,000. And, you know, I love to hear people say, well, we just need to have more guns because, you see, guns can keep you safe. And in Georgia, where the gun capital, I guess, they actually want to loosen restrictions so that people who have mental illness, well, they can get guns. And I just, you know, I think of all this, and you know why I find some humor in some of these gun-related stories? It brings me back to common sense. I mean, we don't need, you know, these studies to tell us that, you know what, people with more guns kill people more often. And they kill themselves more often. You know, if someone commits suicide with a gun, I know they did it, but the gun helped. No? You know, when I was a kid, you know, and I go back to my childhood an awful lot and think about if guns were as pervasive as they are now, especially where I live, there would have been an awful lot more people shot up. And what is that going to cost us? I mean, you think about the costs that come along with this. And USA Today just had a story, I guess it was yesterday or the day before, where they said, look, you know, gunshots cost money. Every time someone gets shot, healthcare costs go up. And in fact, they pointed out that Medicaid and Medicare ended up paying about $1.4 billion a year from gunshot wounds. Not to mention, and this is one of those insurance things, you know, gunshot wounds drive up healthcare premiums. In fact, according to the report put out by USA Today, gunshot wounds and deaths cost Americans at least $12 billion a year in court proceedings, insurance costs, and hospitalization paid by you and me. And, you know, you start thinking about this stuff and you go, well, you know, that's a lot of money, right? Could put that towards education. But I guess that would be too much like a smart thing. And look, I'm not saying take people's guns away. I'm not saying we're going to go and we're going to round them all up. But this whole mentality that we've got, and where was the place the other day that they wanted to mandate that everybody has a gun? Got a carrier sidearm. We're going to turn the nation into the Wild West that never was. Because understand, the Wild West wasn't the Wild West. A lot of areas banned guns. And this simple-minded fear that, oh, the government's going to take over. Let me let you in a little secret. They're better armed already. That ship has sailed. And then you got Lindsey Graham saying, well, when there's a natural disaster, you're going to need your AR-15. No, you're going to need food. You're going to need drinkable water. And a lot of the statements that came out of Katrina, a lot of it was false. Just like they're trying to drum up stuff over with Hurricane Sandy. False. I don't know. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, that's the best place to get our podcast. Also, if you have a smartphone, as, you know, two-thirds of the working people in this country now have and work on from home quite often, you can get the Stitcher app and enjoy a little break of sanity. Think a little bit about something other than pleasing the boss. Maybe think about how to organize and how to come together and maybe get a little bit better raise. Just a thought. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous rain.